dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking with Richard Eskow from Our Future about his piece, The Nihilist Party, Republicans Who Believe in Nothing. And, you know, the more you look at what's been going on the last several months, hard to argue with him. Republicans seem to be standing for nothing that's going to help you or me. But I'm going to disagree a little bit. They do stand on in enriching the wealth class. It'll be interesting talking to Richard. Also in the second hour, Occupy the Boardroom, a new occupation. We're going to be talking with Lisa Tilson, who is a homeowner and activist. Turns out Lisa and her family upside down on their mortgage. She wants to be best friends forever with Heidi Miller of Chase Mortgage. And this Occupy the Boardroom gives you the chance to have a BFF in a boardroom or a pen pal, if you wish. So you can email and let them know what you are thinking of them. So it'll be interesting talking about the Occupy the Boardroom. Also, Kathleen Sharp's going to be here talking about her piece, Anatomy of a $30 Billion Medicare Crime. She's also just released a book called Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. We'll talk to her about that. And in the third hour, Malin Mitchell, Professional Firefighters of Wisconsin president, going to be here talking about the recall effort that's going on in Wisconsin. And, you know, hey, who knows what happens? It would be nice to see them get out and get him, well, put him where he belongs. So today marks the 1 month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. You have seen protesters now spreading throughout the globe. Cities across the country, here in Harrisburg as well. And I look at the amount of money that has just flown into Zuccotti Park there in New York. They're saying some $300,000. And you look at all the arrests that were made over the weekend, all across the country. And there's part of me that wishes that we could see the police, we could see politicians, we could see the district attorneys arresting the criminals that crashed our economy, that caused this economic mess we're in. It would be nice to see that kind of vigor. It would be nice to see that kind of gumption, that kind of spirit, that kind of go-get-em-ness against the Wall Street criminals who caused this mess. But yet, sadly, we only see a handful. And you look across the country in New York, they've, what was the one day they arrested some 700 folks, this weekend, some 70 people, who were in Times Square. Boston, we've seen well over 100 people arrested, as they tried to kick people out of their area. Chicago, another close to 200 kicked out and arrested. Denver, we talked about that last week. Los Angeles, more. San Francisco, Seattle. All across the country, we're seeing really some insanity by the leaders of these cities going, oh, let's go get them, let's break this up, let's kick them out, let's disband this. Because look, the investor class is afraid. I mean, even in Raleigh, North Carolina, there were 19 folks arrested. And yesterday, you had Cornel West, the Princeton professor, him and 19 other people arrested on the steps of the Supreme Court. Why? Protesting Citizens United. The wealth class, they want this. They're happy with the way things are, thrilled to death. They're just tickled pink with the status quo. And I was watching a video this morning of an arrest in Seattle. It took about 40 police officers to arrest just one single woman who decided that she was tired of standing. She's an older woman. She was tired of standing. She was tired of walking around. She was tired of being rained on. So she sat down, opened an umbrella. Evidently in a Seattle park, and again, this is a park, evidently there, that's against the law. It is expressly prohibited and forbidden, and it will go on her permanent record. It will follow her for the rest of her life. Because she sat down, and she opened an umbrella. Evidently, according to the city officials, who have banned such behavior in parks, sitting down and opening umbrellas, that makes a makeshift structure. So, like I said, expressly prohibited, forbidden, never, ever can't do it, not even clinically, even if it's a really sunny day or a really rainy day. I wonder what would happen if you fell down. I guess she just sat down. If you fell down in the rain and had the umbrella, I wonder. They'd probably beat you. But if you look at the video of this woman being arrested, you also see this cop on a bicycle who rammed into somebody. And, you know, again, it sparked another one of these confrontations. But I guess that's a trick that they learned from the NYPD. Because as we talked about last week, the cop actually ran somebody over, knocked him to the ground, ran him over, and his buddies came and beat this guy with nightsticks. So scary, scary stuff going on here in Harrisburg. And you really have to give, and look, I'm not one who gives Linda Thompson credit for very much, but you have to give her credit for not being the heavy hand of the law. You have to give the Capitol Police credit for not being the heavy hand of the law, because in the time that I spent there, the cops were actually pretty supportive, and they were not really the heavy hand like we've seen happen in other cities. Now, I don't know what's going to happen in a week, two, three, five, ten, as this occupation continues. But, you know, as of Friday night, Saturday morning, 00:01, from that time forward, this whole weekend, it was really peaceful. And being out there, meeting people who were there, you get the sense that everything that you're hearing, everything that you're seeing in the mainstream corporate-controlled media is just plain BS. I didn't see any dirty hippies having sex. As I've been told, that's all this is a bunch of dirty hippies having sex, which, again, you know, with all the people having cameras out here, if there's any dirty hippies out there having sex, can you send me those videos? Because I haven't found any. And you would think, with the millions of little cameras and all the little gadgets that record stuff, you would find one case, just one case, of a couple of dirty hippies engaging and fornicating or whatever it is that the right keeps saying they're doing that I haven't seen. What I've seen is I've seen families who were out there with their children. I saw a pair of parents who were out there supporting their son, who's like, you know, hey, I did everything I was supposed to do. The parents did everything they were supposed to do. They helped him pay for college. He did take out some student loans. They spent big bucks. He spent big bucks. And the kid's still living in the basement. And here's the thing. You know, he's just lazy. He won't work. Well, both parents told me, look, he's out there looking for a job. Out there all the time. In fact, we're trying to find him a job. So there's three people looking every single day to find him a job. And guess what? No job. Because they're not there. And this kid actually went to a reputable college, has a reputable degree, and seems like a decent all-around kid. Why can't he find a job? Because they're not there. And I ran into a guy who, you know, I got to be honest, was right about my age, had kids about my kids' age, telling me that since 2008, since the Bush collapse, he is slowly being bled dry. Everything that he had worked for his entire life up until that month of September 2008 when the economy collapsed under Bush, he is slowly, slowly bleeding dry. Lost his house, moved to a smaller place, couldn't afford that, moved to a smaller place. And now you got a number of people living in a very small confined space. He can't find work. He's, you know, again, you got to know that they're having marital problems. You got to know that things are tough. The 401k dried up, all the savings dried up, They were told, you know, hey, you got to have 6 months in reserves. You got to have money set aside. They had all that. Guy can't find a job. And now the longer he's unemployed, the harder it gets. And the more he worries about what's tomorrow. And I hear people saying, well, these are just dregs. These are just the ragtag malcontents. That was one of the, I loved Loman Henry's, that idiot's piece in Sunday's paper. Oh, just malcontents. This is a movement of people who are struggling. You can marginalize it. You can try and narrowly define it. This is a movement of people who are struggling. First question you should ask, do you have a job? And does that job pay enough to feed, house, and clothe you and your family? That's question one. Question two, do you have health insurance? Question three, down the list, are you able to take a day off for whatever reason? You skinned your knee, your kid's sick, the car broke down, you picked your nose, anything. Can you take a day off and not worry about, oh, geez, I'm going to not be able to pay the light bill next month? Or are you one of those folks who are living hand to mouth? Do you have a retirement plan? And is that going to be enough to live on when you get to be 70 or 80? And you're not going to have to take a job as a greeter at 90 years old because everything ran out. If you answered no to any of those things, or to all of them, as a lot of people have, you need to be in the streets. Because the people who are pushing the status quo, they're lying to us. And the reality is, I've been to three of these occupations, and I've yet to see the dirty hippies having sex. And look, if they were, I'm sure there would be some enterprising young filmmaker out there to make the latest, greatest XXX movie, Dirty Hippie Sex 2. I'm sure there would be something. It's not. And I love what we're being told. The right wing is they're all up in arms. Our country is being systematically dismantled, they say. Systematically dismantled? By people who are powerless? Are you kidding me? You talk to most of the people who are at these things. Until this very moment in time, they were disenfranchised. Until this very moment in time, they were voiceless. Until this very moment in time, they felt nobody was listening and nobody was representing them. Explain to me how these kind of people are systematically dismantling our nation. I'm hoping this leads to a dismantling of the system that rewards the ultra-wealthy and punishes the working people. I'm hoping for that. But I'm telling you right now, this is no grand George Soros plan. Labor's not funding this. They don't have the money. Because if George Soros was funding every one of the things that the right claims he was funding, he'd be one of the folks on the steps because he'd be broke. And I love the last, my other favorite frame. The protesters are setting up the police. Because, you know, the protesters, they want to be pepper sprayed. They want to have their heads cracked open. They want to be run over by motorcycles. They want to be handcuffed when they're tired and they want to sit down. That's what these protesters, they wake up in the morning going, gee, if I could just get handcuffed and dragged off to jail and beaten, that would just make my day. I mean, can you believe how idiotic these arguments are? I mean, the whole idea that the protesters are setting up the police, you know someone, a classic abuser, thought that one up. Yeah, she was asking for it. I had to give her a good backhand to keep her in line. It's amazing stuff. Don't believe what they're telling you. Believe what you see, and I encourage everybody to come out and participate with anywhere, wherever there's an occupation, here in Harrisburg or Philadelphia or New York or wherever. Get out into the streets and make noise. Because the only way we get jobs, the only way we get health care, the only way we get this administration or the next to move in a positive direction is by rattling the cage. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Richard Eskow from the Campaign for America's Future. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Anyone who lives in or does business in a big city is likely familiar with the pedal-powered delivery network of bike messengers. Messengers are more often criticized for breaking traffic laws than they are for the important service they provide that few, if any, can. Urban Flow, Bike Messengers and the City is a new book out this month by Jeffrey Kidder, and it explores this often misunderstood culture. Kidder says that bicycles are the best way to deliver items that need to be rushed across a busy downtown.
If you decide something needs to be delivered 5 minutes from now and you want it there 15 minutes from now, you have to go to a different type of service, an on-demand service, and that's what bicycle messengers provide.
Kidder said bike messaging is a risky job combining high-speed cycling with perilous and congested city streets. But he explains the appeal.
The reason messengers are choosing to do this job, aside from, you know, getting a paycheck, is that the job offers a lot of autonomy and creativity and really the ability to act spontaneously throughout the workday. And that's something that's absent in a lot of, or almost all, low-entry, low-wage jobs where management has done a very successful job of sort of structuring out the ability of the worker to make individual choices.
Kidder said additional appeal comes from the creativity involved in mentally mapping the routes.
They have to be creative and spontaneous in how they choose to navigate themselves through traffic. And that, again, that's very satisfying. It's something that we usually see in our leisure pursuits, but not in our workday pursuits. It's in some ways analogous maybe to riding a mountain bike or to going out and rock climbing.
The book is Urban Flow by Jeffrey Kidder, and it's available through Cornell University Press. National Nurses United will provide first aid to Occupy protesters. Doug Cunningham has more.
The nation's largest nurses organization began setting up a first aid station Friday at Occupy Wall Street in New York City. The station will provide basic medical assistance to protesters. National Nurses United says the first aid stations will be expanded to occupy protests in other cities. The nurses say that police and other authorities in New York and the other cities need to respect the rights of the protesters to free speech and assembly. The nurses responded to calls for help with first aid from the protesters. NNU's Registered Nurse Response Network will run the first aid stations. The nurses say volunteer nurses will staff the first aid stations. They say protesters encamped in New York and other cities include many of the most vulnerable in our society, including homeless people, jobless workers, and people without health insurance. The union is encouraging nurses in Occupy protest cities to join their effort to provide first aid stations for the protesters.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there. If you've got a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. So again, if anyone comes across Dirty Hippie Sex Party 2, you can email me at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Can't miss it. You know, evidently there's gotta be one enterprising young filmmaker catching all of this out there. Because the right keeps telling me the dirty hippies are out there and they're fornicating. I haven't seen it yet, but if he's out there, we got to see this. But we've been told an awful lot about this occupation, 99.95% of it false. And I made that up. I'd say close to 100% false. That's why I've asked our good friend Richard Eskow from the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, come talk to us a bit about his piece, The Nihilist Party, Republicans Who Believe in Nothing. Richard, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, it's great to be here, as always.
They believe in nothing? I would say they believe in at least the billionaire class.
Well, that's not a belief. That's a job.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
That's what somebody pays you to do. If you go through what I did in that piece was pretty simple. I just went through everything that Republicans have always said they believe in, whether it's less taxes or smaller government or states' rights or whatever you want to talk about, and whenever it serves the interests of their corporate bosses or of the Koch brothers or billionaires who don't want to pay taxes, whatever it is, they will reverse themselves just like that, in order to keep their paymasters happy. So what I concluded after taking this little look at them was that they really, you know, I mean, I mentioned the Big Lebowski. I don't know if you're a Big Lebowski fan, but they're nihilists. They believe in nothing.
Right.
They will read whatever script is put in front of them, whether it's by Roger Ailes on Fox. And by the way, I was down at Fox last week when I was in Washington defending the Occupy Wall Street folks there, met Michelle Bachmann. But they will read whatever Roger Ailes tells them to say. They will read whatever the Koch brothers tell them to say. There's really no consistent values or point of view in the Republican Party anymore. They'll just say whatever it is they've got to say, either to win or to make the bosses happy. And that's actually a problem, even if you're not a Republican.
Well, it's a problem for the nation. And going back to the Michelle Bachmann, you got to meet her. Is she as hot in person as she looks on TV? I mean, because to me, she is crazy hot. And I love crazy, and she's really, to me.
Well, if you love crazy, bro, then you will definitely think she's hot.
Yes, I do.
You know, I just didn't, you know, I didn't get any of that energy off her. I'll put it that way. And maybe that's why she married the guy she did. I don't know. But, you know, I'll tell you what, if you think her eyes look crazy on TV, though, they look the same in person.
Well, you know, that's one of those turn-on things. You got to love crazy. You spend a weekend with crazy, you marry sane.
Well, just stay off those I'm sure there are websites. Stay off them.
But here again, I mean, you bring this up, and it's a valid point. These folks have, you know, one thing on their mind, and that's their power, and the country be damned. And you look at all of the scorched earth that they've left behind. No jobs plan, no recovery. In fact, hoping and praying that Obama fails from the beginning. We've known this along. Why aren't we revolting?
Well, you know, we were beginning to, and that's what's got them really nervous. But, you know, you take a guy like Herman Cain, who loves to say he's a real conservative. He's funded by the Koch brothers now. That's starting to come out. He's got his 999 plan. And, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, I just took a little look at the 999 plan. That would raise taxes. I thought Republicans were against raising taxes. That would raise taxes on at least half, probably more than half, of all Americans, because once you throw in that sales tax that he wants to put in there, and then make sure that even the poorest working people, if you make a nickel all year, you better pay 9% on that nickel. This is a guy who's actually willing to raise taxes because he wants to shift the burden over to poor people.
Well, you see, here's the thing. They don't care about the bottom half of this country. They really don't. They care about really the top 1%. The rest of you be damned.
Well, the logic, I think, is this. You know, still, you're supposedly supposed to get 51% of the vote to win, but their logic is if they make the wealthiest of the wealthy happy, they'll be flooded with money, and they'll use that money to buy ads to convince people that they represent them. And when you've got an economy as screwed up as this one is, that's a tactic that could easily work.
Yeah, you know, I look at Romney, who, you know, Lincoln Chafee just said, I don't recognize the Mitt Romney I see now. The Mitt Romney I saw before seemed to be a rational guy. This guy, who knows who he is?
Well, you know, I look at Romney's history, and Cain's too, for that matter, and I know that these guys had to be spreadsheet jockeys at one point in their lives, as I used to be. You know, you got to look at a budget. Does it balance? Does it tie out? Does it make sense? I mean, you know, Romney bought and sold companies. He's no idiot. He knows, you know, when numbers make sense and they don't, and yet he's talking complete gibberish right now, and so is Cain. And you know what? These guys know it, and they don't care. I mean, I think back to that moment in the Republican debate when Cain said to Romney, "Can you remember all 59 points in your 59-point plan?" And Romney just laughed. And why shouldn't he laugh? Because nobody expects him to believe this stuff. Nobody expects him to really stand for this stuff. It's just paper he puts out. It was like an insider's joke between two guys who were, you know, working for the same organization.
Yeah, but the thing that scares me about Cain is he seems like a decent guy. He seems like a likable guy. I don't know about him personally, but what he projects is someone that, hey, I'd like to have a beer with him. He's got a sense of humor. But after, he's an insider. He likes to play the outside game, but he's an insider.
Well, he's dangerous to me, and he's dangerous because he is so close to the Koch brothers, and he's dangerous because he will do or say anything, and he's dangerous because, look, he's smart. He's a smart guy. There's no doubt about it. So, and he does seem likable, but, you know, I don't really like the guy either. There's something about him that says to me, untrustworthy.
Shifty.
But, and I'm a guy who could, you know, even see having a beer with Rick Perry, you know, I mean, before I, there's just something about Kane that just, no, he's a cutthroat. That's the way I read him. But he does, there is something likable about him. His humor is kind of, you know, it's funny and self-deprecating, and so I think he's dangerous.
Yeah, and I think this 999 plan is so simplistic that it is dangerous. And look, he's a marketing guy. He understands what it takes to get people to remember your plan. He understands what it takes to get it in people's mind, which is why he keeps repeating it ad nauseum, because he knows it's constant repetition. I think 999 was said, 85 times in the one debate?
And look, it's working for him. And look, that's how he sold pizzas. And, you know, that's how he's selling his candidacy. And if it's not there within a half hour, it's free. Did you know that about Herman Cain? No, it's a little joke. Didn't work.
But, you know, that's what scares me. I mean, what scares me is we're selling the presidency as we would sell a pizza.
Well, of course, look, Romney's no different. Romney will do or say anything, too. And, you know, that's a little bit creepy, too, because you watch him and he's very, very smooth. He's really smooth. You know, he was a consultant for Bain Company, and he reminds me of those guys who would come in and, you know, basically start extracting money from you and taking your company away. He's a very, very smooth operator as well. And I still think it's more likely to be Romney in the end. I think, you know, people are just gravitating to Kane in that party because he seems a little bit more real. But at the end of the day, you know, it's been my experience that Republicans vote the way they're told, and they're being told to vote for Romney. So I'm guessing Romney will still get it, but it could be a Romney-Kane ticket. Who knows?
Oh, that would be, I know, wow, that would be something interesting. But, you know, you look at Kane, and I don't think people really get his background. Yeah, he was the pizza guy who turned the Philadelphia region around for Pillsbury, and, you know, he did work his way up, but he was also I guess he chaired the board of governors for the Kansas Federal Reserve.
Yeah, I mean, that's mostly not exactly a ceremonial position, but close. You know, it's where they get local business people to schmooze with the Federal Reserve Board, which is one of the reasons why the Federal Reserve system is so messed up and needs to change. But, and then, you know, every year one of them serves as the chairman of the board, and so Kane had it, I guess, for a year. And all the guys who worked with him back then say, you know, he was a mainstream Federal Reserve guy. You know, the conservatives and the Tea Party types are supposedly so outraged at the Federal Reserve. But, you know, they're all saying, nah, Kane was just one of us. He was just another guy who thought the same way we think. And, you know, he had an undergraduate degree in math, and I think he got a master's in computer, you know, programming or something. So, you know, he knows numbers. He's not irrational or crazy. He can, you know, he can add and subtract. So he knows what he's saying is bogus.
But, you know, I look at this, and again, you know, having that position, and you say it's ceremonial, and I've heard that before, but at the end of the day, it's still an insider's position.
Oh,
someone that gets you in the room.
Oh, there's no question about it. No, he's been a player for a long time. And look, he's been a big player in the conservative movement. I don't know if you remember, if your listeners remember, he was the guy when Bill Clinton was trying to sell his health plan in 94 or 5, and met with a whole group of businessmen. It was Herman Cain who stood up and said, you know, the numbers don't add up on your plan, and I'll have to fire people if your plan becomes law, and really decimated, you know, Clinton's momentum on that whole thing. He was kind of the businessman's Joe the Plumber of his day. You know, his confrontation with Clinton really helped to kill that health plan, and that's how he started to become a conservative hero. So he's been around for a while.
Yeah, I mean, he made his bones early, and but he's playing that outsider card, and I think most people who aren't going to remember that, and most people who aren't going to dig into it, are going to think, oh, he was just some guy who was running a company, and he just loves America, and he's thrown his hat into the ring.
Yeah, and you think, you know, pizza company, you think, well, he's some guy who just had a better recipe, you know, and the, and went out and bought the freshest anchovies at the farmer's market, you know. No, this is a guy who took it over, as you say, for a corporation, and they said, Herman, turn this thing around, and he went in and did a good job, and then he got a bunch of the other executives and got some investors and bought it out from the parent corporation and made himself a big bundle that way. But he's not a, he was never an entrepreneur or a small businessman. He was a corporate guy from the get-go.
Yeah, he wasn't the guy actually flipping the pizza.
Yeah, I mean, he's not like Famous Amos with his cookies or whatever. You know, this is a guy, he never flipped a pizza in his life. Yeah. So, he's a corporate guy. That's all he is.
Yeah. Lastly, I've seen this last week at the end of the week. We saw this thing, this 53% movement. So last week I took a couple of the shots, of people, who put up their 53%. And I wish we had a chance to talk to those people. Because as you read through, I was in the Marines. I worked three jobs, 70 hours a week. I don't have health care. This, that, the other thing. And I don't whine. I'm one of the 53%. I'm going, well, you should be one of the people who are out in the streets. If you served your country and your country has turned their back on you, if you're working three jobs, can't pay your bills, and you still have no health care, you're exactly the person who should be complaining.
But you see, this is what these guys on the right do. They make you blame other people who are getting the short end of the stick instead of the people who are doing the cheating, because that's exactly what they do. The 53% meaning that there are 47% of Americans who don't pay federal taxes. Well, one thing about that is I love how these guys always say that the payroll tax that supports Medicare and Social Security is taxation and not something that goes into your future benefits, so just shut those programs down. But then they turn around and pretend like it's not taxes at all when they want to say 53%, because everybody who works for a living pays the payroll tax. So, with a very few exceptions. So, all those people are paying taxes to the federal government for their Medicare and Social Security. So it's not 47% of people that don't pay anything. Plus they pay sales taxes and they pay other kinds of taxes. So that's a phony number anyway, but the reason they do that is so you don't start pointing your finger, wait a minute, I paid for my Social Security all my life and now you're going to cut it. Instead of pointing fingers at the people who are doing that, then you're going to turn around and say, who are these people who aren't pulling their weight like I am? It's smart. It's devious, but it's smart.
Yeah, you got to give them credit. They're excellent at dividing and conquering. They're excellent at slicing and dicing us. I always go back to Jay Gould, the railroad magnate from the 1880s. I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half.
I never heard that quote, but that's pretty much what this 53% is, except for its elitist, ringmasters.
Yeah, that's my favorite one. It was the girl who's 18 going to college. Her father works 70 hours a week and pays 40% tax, but she doesn't want any handouts, and she's one of the 53%. Her father pays for her school, and she babysits. She doesn't pay federal tax at all, but she's one of the 53%. You want to talk about diluted?
Interesting, yeah.
And I would say that her father's paying way too much for her education, because if she can't figure that simple equation out, there's a problem with the education system. Maybe.
And if she's getting more than $600 in babysitting money from the same employer, they should be filing. Well, never mind.
Never mind that. Maybe she should be asking, do you want fries with that? Richard Oskow, I appreciate the time. Always great talking to you.
Same here.
The Campaign for America's Future. Thanks so much, Richard.
You bet.
Let's take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Come to talk.
If you had any doubt about the seriousness of the Occupy Wall Street movement that's springing up from America's grassroots like hardy wildflowers, just note the frantic fulminations against it by assorted Wall Street toadies. The corporate cheerleaders on CNBC, for example, reached back to the nasty days of McCarthyism to smear the youthful protesters as, quote, aligned with Lenin. Little Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, who loyally serves the banksters as their Washington lapdog, yapped in alarm about the growing mobs occupying Wall Street. Then came Mitt Romney, himself a former Wall Streeter, to warn darkly against the protesting rabble, "I think it's dangerous, this class warfare." Even more clueless is Herman Cain, previously the CEO of Godfather's Pizza chain, who's now running for president. He can't stop foaming at the mouth about the Wall Street occupation. Anti-American, he labeled the protesters, later blasting them as losers who are jealous of successful people. "Don't blame Wall Street," he lectured. "If you don't have a job and you're not rich, blame yourself." To put the icing on his half-baked cupcake of ignorance, Cain then expressed his deep understanding of economics. "To protest Wall Street and the bankers is basically saying you're anti-capitalism," he expounded. A plutocratic theory that America's millions of conservative small business capitalists would consider perverse. But wait, there are more Cainisms. "These demonstrations," he complained, "I honestly don't understand. What are they looking for?" This is Jim Hightower saying, "Gosh, Godfather, if you have to ask a question like that, you're way too out of touch to be president. What we're looking for are such old-fashioned American fundamentals, by which I mean economic fairness, social justice, and equal opportunities for all. That's what America stands for."
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. The Borowitz Report, as arrests mounted on in the Occupy Wall Street protest in New York City, Libya's National Transitional Council issued a stern statement today warning the NYPD to exercise restraint. According to the statement, the Libyan transitional government regards any attempt to infringe upon the American protesters' rights to express themselves as a violation of international standards of free speech and liberty. They went on to say, "We will not sit idly by and watch this happen." The Libyan government also said that if the arrests continued, it would consider forming a NATO coalition to ensure the safety and security of the American people. While it did not state its explicit goal, insiders believe that if the arrests continue, Libya may seek to ouster New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, whose whereabouts remain unknown. Perhaps in response to the Libyan statement, the U.S. State Department today responded with a statement of its own, saying the U.S. is 100% opposed to suppression of popular uprisings as long as they're not happening here. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Bill on line one. How you doing tonight, Bill?
Lousy, Rick, but thanks for asking.
Sorry to hear that.
I was listening to that was a great story you just had. I was listening to R.J. Harris this morning on 580, and he was talking about that Bay Bridge in California and the fact that, the Chinese got the contract for it, and they're also bringing in Chinese workers to do the work, like we don't have steel workers.
The engineers,
And then he brought up, and this is, maybe you're aware of this, but I hadn't heard it before, the King Monument in Washington they dedicated yesterday, that was made in China.
Parts of it, yes.
When are people going to finally get the picture? I don't get it anymore. I mean, everybody should be up in arms anymore than crap.
Yeah, and this is where, I've been saying this for some time. This is where I think even the most radical on the right, even someone like R.J. Harris, and I can agree.
Oh, he was mad. He was real mad about it. Oh, big time.
And I think this is this occupation movement across the country is focusing on those issues.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And as much as the mainstream corporate-controlled media is pushing it away from that, saying, oh, they're just a bunch of dirty hippies having sex, it's really about the core economic issues. And I don't care where you stand politically. Making things in the U.S., spending our money domestically, that's the way we get ourselves out of this economic mess. And if he's saying that, good on him. Very little I agree with that comes out of his mouth. But,
right.
But if he's saying that, good on him.
Yep. Well, he just got to realize what side he's on eventually, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, but you can't continue to push a pro-corporate agenda where the investor class always wins and then expect them to not do those kind of things where they can profit.
Yep, that's absolutely right. No, we're reaching a point of insanity now. Something's got to give. Something absolutely has to give. We're going to lose our country altogether, and everybody's going to wake up, in change before this is all said and done.
Yeah, and the reality is that neither party's the answer at this point. I mean, look at those trade agreements that happened last week.
Yes.
You got 83.
I know.
You got 83 of them, 83 senators to vote for South Korea, 77 for Colombia and Panama. That's bipartisan.
It's going to create jobs, Rick. Come on, it's going to create a lot of jobs. You know that. Not here, though.
South Korea and in China.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I don't know.
Now, this whole left-right thing, too, it's a circus trick. I mean, categorize people, get them fight with each other. I've said for years and years and years, that's what the whole problem we have is. We got to start realizing, that we really are one people. And stop with fighting amongst each other while these puppet masters call the shots.
Yeah, but here's the problem with that. I mean, you do really have two very different opposing views in this country.
Oh yeah.
And it's the same ones that go back to the founding. The Civil War for a short time, I think, solved that. But we're having the same arguments that we had up until the Civil War.
Well, this is a big repeat of the 1890s, with robber barons and everything.
Yeah, that's right where we are.
We are. We sure are.
And I'm happy to see people in the streets, Bill.
You and me both, Rick.
Thanks so much, brother.
Thanks for doing a good job and good talking to you.
I appreciate it. Call again. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Let's talk to Lori online, too. How are you doing tonight, Lori?
Good. How are you doing, Rick?
I am great, and I'm getting better every day.
Good to hear. Hey, I've been out on with the Occupy Harrisburg movement, and some of the folks that come around, I just thought it was interesting how the difference in the way we look at the world versus some other people look at the world, because some of the folks have been coming by and wanting to challenge us, wanting to know why we aren't out there earning money, making a living, building wealth for ourselves. And, of course, a lot of us out there do have jobs, and we are working hard, but we know what it's like to, be on to be struggling. And that's why we're out there supporting our brothers and sisters who are out there. But the people who are showing up with some of their video cameras and stuff, they're saying, well, why aren't you out building wealth? As if, we couldn't, it's only about us, and not the other, not being out there together. And I was just wondering what you had to say about that kind of mindset.
Well, I got to be honest with you. That's what separates what you guys are doing out there here in Occupy Harrisburg and across the country. It is about the collective. It's about we. It's about we, the people. As where the Tea Party thing is more about me. How do I hold on to what I've got? Most of the people you saw, who came out in the Tea Party things were people that are a little older. They've got their house, they've got their things, and they want to hold on to it. The folks that I've met with the occupation stuff. They want to be able to have those things, and they want everybody else to as well. So they want to see the collective do as well and themselves do better. And it's about creating jobs. It's about an economy that works for all. And really, it's about holding those accountable who have really screwed this country over.
That's that right.
That's my basic thought on it. And, if you had to break it down to a soundbite, the occupation movement for we the people and the Tea Party for me the person. Simple stuff.
Well, it's been great being out there with I've been hearing so many terrific stories about people out there looking out for each other. It's really been wonderful.
And, when we were out over the weekend, I had a great time talking to people and collecting their stories. And the more people that will come out of the woodwork, and I've been calling for this for the longest time, people to come out from the shadows and say, this is my story. This is why things need to change. I talked about a guy earlier, a family guy, lost his job. He's bleeding dry. Every day he's getting that much worse off. Why? Can't find a job.
Well,
Lori, I appreciate the call, and please call back again soon.
All right. Take care, Rick.
Thanks
Bye.
So much. You look at this, and the reality is what it is. these folks want what every person wants, an economy that works, something where they can send their kids to school, a well-funded school with a reasonable-sized class and a teacher who's professional and well-paid, in safe neighborhoods. They want to be able to raise their family, feed their kids, clothe them. They want the American dream. And what's been going on the last 30 years is we've been sliding towards the American nightmare, where people who want to work hard, who want to go back to work, can't find jobs. And we've got a party in this country, and look, the Democrats, they've tried and kind of failed. When they had the steamroll majority, they didn't move. But now you've got the party of no. The party of no ideas, the party of no vision. And they're standing in the way of any recovery until the 2012 election. That's what all this is about. You know, the Republicans have a jobs bill now, and what is it? It's the exact stuff that got us into the mess we're in. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job. They're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer is a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. So this weekend was the memorial ceremony in D.C. For the Martin Luther King Memorial, and his daughter was there, And she said, you know what, he would have supported the 99% movement, Bernice King, in a passionate speech on Sunday morning at the MLK Memorial Ceremony. He said, look, I hear my father saying what we are seeing now all across the streets of America and the world is a freedom explosion. She said the deep rumbling of discontent we hear today is the thunder of disinherited masses rising from the dungeons of oppression to the bright hills of freedom. She said, as we protest here today, we must conduct ourselves in a higher plane of dignity and discipline. And look, you know, I look at the fact that it was sculpted by a Chinese guy and it was done with a whole bunch of Chinese labor, and I say, you know, another one of those examples of a missed opportunity to put people back to work and really be wrong. The wrong impression, the wrong decision. She went on to say, we should never adjust to the 1% controlling the more than 40% of wealth. We should never adjust to unprecedented number of people unemployed. We should never adjust to any person being without health care because they cannot afford it. We should never adjust to an increase of people moving into poverty. And we should never adjust to a judicial system that allows us to take a life when guilt is yet in question. Talking about Troy Davis. And, you know, look, at the end of this, the Republicans are, and I heard the Becks and the Limbaughs and them going on about, oh, how could Martin Luther King wouldn't be standing for this? He was a Republican. I don't think that had anything to do with it. I think the folks that are out in the streets today are people that he would have. That he would have stood with. People who are looking for a job. People who need health care. People who need opportunity. Absolutely, positively, I do believe he would have been standing with them.
If you study his life, Rick, you know that Martin Luther King not only stood up against prejudice and racial prejudice, but he also stood up against poverty. And he often talked about war and the cost of war and how that takes away from our ability to take care of people, and he also talked about how unjust he felt, how unfair it was to the poor, the death sentence. So if you look at all those positions, there's no question in my mind that he would have been out in front of this movement, absolutely.
And you know, you love to hear. I was listening to one of the talking heads the other day talking about Martin Luther King, saying that he would have never been out there standing with those Union thugs. I'm going, well, did you not know why he was down south there when he got shot? Anybody have any idea why he was there? Why he was down in that area?
Yeah, had to do with the AFSCME strike.
The Garbage Workers Union. Union, again, you know, but they rewrite history and they keep saying, well, he wouldn't stand with those union people. He did, often. Because... And this is where I hope this occupation thing goes, because out of all this, and while labor is not funding and is not behind it, has nothing to do with it, this is a true grassroots uprising. I'm hoping that the people there say, you know what, the way we get to social justice is through economic social justice, is by saying on the job people should have rights. Now, however you get to that point, that's the direction, getting a fair slice of the pie. I mean, you can grow the pie as big as you want. If your piece is still just a sliver, it's just a sliver. And that's where I'm hoping that part of this becomes an education process into how do we get to the place where my grandparents' generation got, which is a fair shake in the economy, a fair slice of that economic pie. How do you get there? And how you get there is by saying, you know what, we're going to collectively bargain. We're going to stand together. Now, what that looks like in the future, I'm not sure. But that's, to me, the answer. All the other stuff will then come, as it did then. So I think it's pretty simple in my view. Anyway, according to a USA Today Gallup poll, 54% of Americans say that the economic system treating them fairly. 44% say not so much. When asked who's to blame for the current economic system, 64% of the folks polled said Washington, D.C., and 30% said Wall Street. And you know, you look at this and you go, this is why the elites are scared. This is why the elites are worried. This is why they've got their spin machine 24/7 bashing these people as lazy or scumbags or desperate or violent hippies having sex and drugs, because they want you to turn your back on them. They've worked very hard. They really have. The investor class has worked very hard convincing us that everything is Washington, D.C.'s fault. And they don't want people doing any of that bar thinking. Don't want to do none of that. Because then you'll wake up and you'll realize that the policies pushed out of Washington were lobbied for by the people on Wall Street. And until we get the money out of the system, it's going to continue to be that way. So, yeah, it's easy to blame Washington. But it's just as easy to blame Wall Street, which is where the money is coming from. Anyway, 45% who were polled said they place a great deal of blame on the financial institutions, and 33% say a fair amount of blame. But almost 9 in 10 assign Washington either a great deal of blame or a fair amount of blame. And also in the poll, the occupation movement rising. Numbers, people going, hey, I'm with you, I'm getting it. Tea Party falling. People getting that, too. It's all about me. It's all about, the status quo. More than half of Americans, 55%, said they don't really know enough yet about the occupation one way or the other. But here again, as this continues to unfold, and as stupid police departments across the country beat up on these people, I think you're going to see more folks coming around. And Greg Sargent asked an interesting question today. Over at the Washington Post. What if working-class Americans actually like Occupy Wall Street? What if white working-class, blue-collar types, people like me, see this movement as taking on the real issues? You know, the real issues that ticked off the Tea Party? I mean, as I've said a number of times, right at the very beginning, I was with them. That spark of anger, that frustration, right there. But then they lost me when they took that weird kind of, it's Washington's fault and it's not corporate America's fault. Corporate America's the answer, they say. That's where they lost me. And I think that's where they've lost a lot of people in the working class. And that's why I think, as you're seeing, the folks from Working America are saying, you know, during this occupation thing, we've come up with, just last week, 25,000 new people have signed up for Working America as were during the things in Wisconsin. They were only getting 15,000 to 20,000 people signing up. So this has been an awakening, I think. And it'll be interesting to see in a couple of weeks if they can sustain. And I know here in Harrisburg, there are people out there around the clock. You know, the numbers swell, the numbers fall, but people keep coming back because, you know what, they've got jobs to go to. They've got to feed their families. They've got to get a life to lead, but they want to be involved in this. And they know that this is the direction we need to be heading in. These are the conversations that have to be had. If we're going to turn this country around, if we're going to make this a prosperous country for all of us, not just a handful, these are conversations that have to be had and issues that have to be addressed. Now, when this comes to the ballot box, all these people are going to have to vote. And you're going to have to pursue a course that... much like the Tea Party was good at doing. They got their people in office. We need to start pushing people. Say, look, you don't stand with us, you're against us, and you get rid of it. I don't care what party you are. Those trade agreements, for one. But that's what we're hoping for. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to talk with Lisa Tilson. She's the homeowner and activist with OccupyTheBoardroom.org. She wants to be the BFF with Heidi Miller of Chase. That's her mortgage underwriter. So why not talk to the person who has your mortgage in hand? And you can have a BFF too. Just go to OccupyTheBoardroom.org. Quick break. Back with Lisa Tilson. Stick around.
You're listening to
to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Anyone who lives in or does business in a big city is likely familiar with the pedal-powered delivery network of bike messengers. Messengers are more often criticized for breaking traffic laws than they are for the important service they provide that few, if any, can. Urban Flow, Bike Messengers and the City is a new book out this month by Jeffrey Kidder, and it explores this often misunderstood culture. Kidder says that bicycles are the best way to deliver items that need to be rushed across a busy downtown.
If you decide something needs to be delivered 5 minutes from now and you want it there 15 minutes from now, you have to go to a different type of service, an on-demand service, and that's what bicycle messengers provide.
Kidder said bike messaging is a risky job combining high-speed cycling with perilous and congested city streets. But he explains the appeal.
The reason messengers are choosing to do this job, aside from, you know, getting a paycheck, is that the job offers a lot of autonomy and creativity and really the ability to act spontaneously throughout the workday. And that's something that's absent in a lot of, or almost all, low-entry, low-wage jobs where management has done a very successful job of sort of structuring out the ability of the worker to make individual choices.
Kidder said additional appeal comes from the creativity involved in mentally mapping the routes.
They have to be creative and spontaneous in how they choose to navigate themselves through traffic. And that, again, that's very satisfying. It's something that we usually see in our leisure pursuits, but not in our workday pursuits. It's in some ways analogous maybe to riding a mountain bike or to going out and rock climbing.
The book is Urban Flow by Jeffrey Kidder, and it's available through Cornell University Press. National Nurses United will provide first aid to Occupy protesters. Doug Cunningham has more.
The nation's largest nurses organization began setting up a first aid station Friday at Occupy Wall Street in New York City. The station will provide basic medical assistance to protesters. National Nurses United says the first aid stations will be expanded to Occupy protests in other cities. The nurses say that police and other authorities in New York and the other cities need to respect the rights of the protesters to free speech and assembly. The nurses responded to calls for help with first aid from the protesters. NNU's Registered Nurse Response Network will run the first aid stations. The nurses say volunteer nurses will staff the first aid stations. They say protesters encamped in New York and other cities include many of the most vulnerable in our society, including homeless people, jobless workers, and people without health insurance. The union is encouraging nurses in Occupy protest cities to join their effort to provide first aid stations for the protesters.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Smith Show. That's a good question. Why can't we be friends? And, you know, I've often wondered what it would be like to have a BFF, a best friend forever, with someone sitting in a corporate boardroom, one of the CEOs, one of the big investor class folks. Well, now you can. Thanks to the folks at OccupyTheBoardroom.org, you too can be the BFF with any of your favorite CEOs from the big banking industry, which is why I've asked Lori Tilson, homeowner, activist, and hopefully BFF with one of her favorite banking executives, Heidi Miller of Chase. Lisa, thanks for taking time for us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So now you're BFFs with Heidi Miller. Is that true?
Well, I'm working on it. I just started writing her yesterday. I was actually I had 2 weeks of a lot of travel for work, and so and Sunday I was so exhausted. I was just sort of like going on Facebook and saw this incredible opportunity to link up with these folks on Wall Street. And my immediate reaction was I would love to just go after Goldman Sachs because I've read so much about how they are instrumental in bringing down the financial industry. But Chase is really actually much more personal to my life. It's who I had a checking account with up until today and also who we have our mortgage with. So I decided to click on they have a whole selection of different, you know, CEOs and also like just upper management executives. So you can scroll through and then choose the one that you want to correspond with. And I decided I just felt more comfortable with a woman.
Right.
So Heidi, you know, I didn't have her picture, but it had her name, and she was one of the only women with Chase. So I selected her. I wrote her a letter, and it has a lot of creative ideas as to how you can, you know, approach this and follow up. But I wrote her a letter that basically gave a very initial summary of my story, which is that we bought our house in 2005 at the height of the bubble, and for various reasons, we got an interest-only loan so that we could afford to be in the house that I had been in with my ex-husband for about 8 years before that.
Right.
And so we're not like morons that were speculating on the market or, you know, any of that. And it was real personal for us to stay in the house. And now it's just, you know, it's ridiculous. Our house is like $200,000 underwater. So we've talked about doing a modification for a number of months now. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll just start writing this woman and giving her little bits of my story. And, you know, they claim that they're going to print these out and deliver them once a week. And let's see what happens.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea because maybe they've never really been amongst the rest of us. And they just don't know. I mean, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe in their, you know, their gilded offices, maybe in their gated communities, on their private planes, and their private islands, they just don't deal with the rest of us rabble. So maybe some input from us might help educate them.
Well, I find it really interesting, just on my own block, people that, you know, I have a very mixed community of Republicans and Democrats, and folks that, you know, we're nice neighbors to each other, but it's, you know, I've actually gone next door to try to get a petition signed for something from a Republican neighbor, and they've been very hostile. And that neighbor was laid off from her job. She's in her mid-50s. She flat out will say she doesn't expect ever to get rehired again. And I'm hearing about foreclosures, you know, across the street. The neighbor stopped paying their mortgage. I don't even think this is a partisan issue anymore. I think this is, really affecting real people. And, you know, I actually, it's funny, like I'm writing, you know, what I think are kind of humorous letters to her, sort of my sorority sister coming out, but it really is like an opportunity to have a conversation. And, you know, who knows, maybe if I'm doing this for the next 30 days, it'll have some sort of cognitive story that if she actually reads them makes, you know, hits her in some level.
Yeah, that's the hope anyway. And again, if anyone wants to have their own personal relationship or they want to be a BFF, best friends forever with one of these executives, you can go to occupytheboardroom.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. You can just click on Lisa Tilson's name. It'll take you right there. And you can choose from a list of CEOs and corporate bigwigs that you can correspond with, as Lisa has done. You know, you look at this thing and you say you're underwater on your mortgage, which I'm sure a good number of people in your neighborhood are. And this is where I believe this Occupy thing across the country is pulling people into the streets. Because look, I don't care what political party, I don't care what political ideology you have, this hits all of us the same. If you go down, you're gonna take me down with you. And,
that's right.
And so on across the spectrum. So this has got to be something where there's got to be a solution. So let me ask you, where do you think we go? Personally, I was a big fan of you know, reenacting the home loan ownership corporation. back from the Roosevelt days, where the government would buy the loans back at today's value with a very low interest rates to kind of stabilize the free fall. We didn't do that. We tried to kiss up to the banks. I'm curious where your thoughts are.
Well, I think, I read a ton on this, and I'm reading, the manifestos and the suggestions coming out of the Occupy movement. You know, a lot of it is debt forgiveness. Of course, I think we all would have loved to have seen more, debt forgiveness and negotiation with homeowners from, the administration and the programs they provided. But I see that, Wall Street's been given a chance to do right. It's not like this is a new crisis. It's not like people haven't been saying this is a problem. And, in the history of, the world, if the corporatists don't do the right thing, the ones that provide labor to keep the wheel going basically stop moving the wheel. And that's, you just sit down. And, I'm from a union background. That's what a strike is. That's what a boycott is. And I see that I think that we're as close as we've ever been in this country to basically shutting it down. And, I never thought in my lifetime I would see this, nor do I want to. I wish that they would do the right thing and that we could all, move on and be prosperous and happy. But I saw an article today about some of the other, like South American countries that had crises in the 2000s that basically, and Iceland is a great example, basically throwing out the government. Not that I suggest we overthrow the government, but, essentially setting up cooperatives, it may just turn out that people stop collectively paying their mortgage if it turns out that they're not willing to do anything.
Because that was going to be my next question. I mean, you claim you're pretty deep underwater. At some point it becomes where, it's just not a value anymore to pay the mortgage. It's just probably economically in your best interest just to leave the keys in the door and walk away and go into something else.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, and, that's certainly a consideration. It's the same consideration that a lot of these corporations have done. And the fact that they would, I actually find it totally, really repulsive that the big banks would even have, credit ratings anymore. I mean, it's just like, really? Like, you guys got bailed out, you guys really screwed up, and you want to evaluate my credit? I don't think so.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, the hypocrisy of it all.
It is.
That somehow they're worthy and we're not. And, again, it comes back down to, you and I, very few of us, you or me, have lobbyists to be able to push our interests.
Well, I have three children. I have a son at the University of Virginia, a freshman, actually first year, they don't call it freshman. I have a junior in high school daughter, and I have a six-year-old kindergarten daughter. This is personal to me. Like, I feel like I'm on a timeline where this has to be solved. I mean, my son needs a job in 3 years, and I don't want to see a world where their lives are worse off than mine.
And, when I'm out on the, when we're at these occupations, the folks who are my age and older, that's the sentiment I get from most people who are, I'm in my 40s, and most people a little bit older say the same thing. I want the same thing for my kids and my grandchildren that I had, the ability to work hard and to get ahead. And, one of the things I had hoped for this president, that he'd be the guy who saved work in this country by properly rewarding it. And you look at our tax code, there's very little reward for people to actually do hard work.
That's right. And I actually work for a union as a retiree coordinator. And, for me, the key word that ties everything together that I think we're all on the same page about is security. Whether you talk about economic security, whether you talk about retirement security, health security, we all function at our finest when we feel secure. And that's why we're at such a pivotal point in our history right now, is that you can't get any more insecure when you don't have a job, when you don't have health insurance, when you don't have a place to live. I mean, that's where we are right now. And so that's the desperation that is out there. And there's no, I was actually at Wall Street 2 weeks ago, and it's amazing. I mean, I was privileged enough to walk with the 20,000 people on October 5th, and I've never felt so energized in my life. So, I mean, I'm hoping for the best. I really do think that things will be better. There's a sign on Facebook that says, be excited about the beginning. I'm hoping that's what this is. But, it can't get any worse than it is.
Well, don't say that. It could always, if we had Pat Toomey in charge, who's the senator here from Pennsylvania, he wanted a much harder down. So the crash would have been much harder and the dig and the climb back upward would have been much harder. Fortunately, we didn't have to worry. We didn't have him. But at the end of this, you're right. For me, that economic security you talked about, that's the key to the economy. That's the key to getting people to open their wallets and to buy things again and to get this economy moving, because we do live in a demand economy.
Right.
Simple stuff. Again, occupytheboardroom.org, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Lisa Tilson's name. Lisa, I appreciate the time. Keep up the good work. Keep up the fight, and we'd love to know what's going on. If you get a response back from Heidi Miller from Chase, that would be something pretty amazing.
I will for sure come back on your show if I get a response.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Lisa.
All right. Thanks so much.
All
take
right.
care.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
If you had any doubt about the seriousness of the Occupy Wall Street movement that's springing up from America's grassroots like hardy wildflowers, just note the frantic fulminations against it by assorted Wall Street toadies. The corporate cheerleaders on CNBC, for example, reached back to the nasty days of McCarthyism to smear the youthful protesters as, quote, aligned with Lenin. Little Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, who loyally serves the banksters as their Washington lapdog, yapped in alarm about the growing mobs occupying Wall Street. Then came Mitt Romney, himself a former Wall Streeter, to warn darkly against the protesting rabble. I think it's dangerous, this class warfare. Even more clueless is Herman Cain, previously the CEO of Godfather's Pizza Chain, who's now running for president. He can't stop foaming at the mouth about the Wall Street occupation. Anti-American, he labeled the protesters, later blasting them as losers who are jealous of successful people. Don't blame Wall Street, he lectured. If you don't have a job and you're not rich, blame yourself. To put the icing on his half-baked cupcake of ignorance, Cain then expressed his deep understanding of economics. To protest Wall Street and the bankers is basically saying you're anti-capitalism, he expounded. A plutocratic theory that America's millions of conservative small business capitalists would consider perverse. But wait, there are more Cainisms. These demonstrations, he complained, I honestly don't understand. What are they looking for? This is Jim Hightower saying, gosh, Godfather, if you have to ask a question like that, you're way too out of touch to be president. What we're looking for are such old-fashioned American fundamentals, by which I mean economic fairness, social justice, and equal opportunities for all. That's what America stands for.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. And, of course, if you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, download the Stitcher app, and you can take your program on the go. So today, back in 1973, Jake, you'll remember this, the OPEC nations implemented their oil diplomacy policy, which was no OPEC-producing nation could sell oil to any nation that supported Israel in the Yom Kippur War with Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. That pretty much ended the era of cheap oil, and the New York Stock Exchange plummeted by some $97 billion. And what you saw was the big, deep recession of 73-74. Massive collapse there. The oil diplomacy, well, hit here the hardest. Domestic production was already at a low pace. Reserves, well, we didn't quite have that many. And we were already importing 27% of our crude from the OPEC people that year. Gasoline prices shot through the roof. By December of 73, they had jumped 130%. And by the end of it, 387% higher than the year before. And I'm sure you'll remember the people waiting in lines for hours across the country. Prices at the pump, no bargain there, climbed as high as 84 cents a gallon, up from 38 just a few months earlier. Pretty much ended the end of the big three, because they were selling the big gas guzzlers and the trucks. And what's amazing to me is the UAW for years, from the 50s, had been telling them, you need to build some smaller cars. You need to do that. But not so much profit in that.
Oh, I remember. I remember waiting in line for several hours. I remember interest rates going through the roof. And it wasn't long after that. Middle 70s, late 70s, you started to see the Japanese and their little we call them rice jumpers, appearing, because the American car manufacturer decided that they wanted to be greedy and they wanted to keep selling the big ones simply because they made more per unit. And the Japanese were years ahead of us and took advantage of that.
Yeah, and they were making the smaller cars, which, you look back to that and you go, why haven't we been pursuing policies to get away from OPEC? Why haven't we been getting away from imported oil? Why haven't we been working diligently to get off oil altogether? And you look at with the Solyndra thing, the Republicans are just all tingly in the panties so that they can assault solar power or any alternative energy. Fake news at Fox last week had it really just an all-out assault. Every word that came out of their mouth, most of it not true, were bashing this Sun Power Company, who's evidently building some pretty big stuff in Arizona and California. They were saying, no, all that stuff's being built in Mexico. No, it's not. But what it is, what they're trying to do, they're working their hardest to kill it, take us back to the oil, keep us dependent. Much like 73, we didn't learn the lessons from 1973. Evidently not, because we didn't learn the lessons of the 70s from the hijackers either. I mean, during the 70s, they were hijacking planes left and right. Didn't learn that lesson. And I guess, Churchill was right. Americans always do the right thing after doing everything else first. So I guess we have to continue to do the wrong things, and maybe we'll get it right. I don't know. Reuters has a report that just came out, news story, a report by the research firm Bloomberg New Energy Finance. They released this last Wednesday, said wind farm and solar park financing surged to a record $41.8 billion in the third quarter of this year, even as energy share prices drop in the clean energy sector and the European economy slumped. You're seeing this overall investment because I think people get it. The wind farm stuff up because, there's in the North Sea, there's a 1 gigawatt capacity wind farm being built. That's a $6.3 billion investment. We're seeing large numbers of photovoltaics. We're seeing solar thermal biofuel projects all across the U.S. We're seeing investments in China, especially. A big portion of this is there. But here's the thing, though. We just don't have the demand yet. People don't have the money. If we had more people who were able to buy solar panels, put them on their house, you would see the production pick up even further, and this could really take off and get us off the grid. That's the part of this that I think most people are forgetting. If we could just get off of, in our homes, off the oil, no more heating oil, no more any of that. Make our homes energy independent. That would be a huge thing for national security. And then maybe start looking at transportation. And I don't know if you saw this last week, but Mayor Rahm Emanuel, and thank goodness he's mayor instead of chief of staff, he introduced a new policy there in Chicago. He's saying, look, all city employees, public transportation is the preferred method of travel for all Chicago city employees. The new ROM rule, say employees who do not take public transportation, well, they're going to have to explain why. You want to be reimbursed? You got to say why. ROM has capped the per day mileage reimbursement at 50 miles, and employees must drive at least 5 miles to be reimbursed if there's no public transportation available. He's hoping it's going to save the city of Chicago $1 million in the next year. 500,000 by people, you know, using public transportation, 500,000 through the mileage caps. You know, I look at this and I go, at some point, public transportation is going to be the way to go. And if you saw the AP story last week, Amtrak hit a record, carrying more than 30 million passengers in the past 12 months. The year before, they did pretty well, but still not the 30 million that they had done. This is the highest number of riders since Amtrak was created some 40 years ago. Ridership went up, money went up. A smart thing. You may remember, though, Republicans back in September, and I think it was a House Appropriations Subcommittee, who passed a bill slashing the Amtrak funding by 60%. Now, the funding, as I remember, had been like $563 million, which it would have been for each of the past 2 years. Republicans slashed it down to $227 million. 60% slash and burn. And what they wanted to do, they want to privatize the Northeast Corridor. So, you know, the most profitable part of it, much like they want to do it here in Pennsylvania with the Port Authority in Allegheny County. They want to privatize just the prime lines, the, you know, the money-making lines. Why? Well, because they want to stick you and me with things that don't work so that they can then say, see, it doesn't work, we need to kill it. And Nick Rahal, Democrat from West Virginia, said Americans are returning to the rails in record numbers, yet Republicans are pulling out all the stops in their rush to auction off Amtrak's assets to the highest bidder on Wall Street. And I would argue it's not even the highest bidder. It's whoever they can get a campaign contribution from. The folks at the National Association of Railroad Passengers also said that the GOP cuts, quote, would be tantamount to shutting down the entire Amtrak network because of remaining routes. They couldn't cover the cost of the system overloads, couldn't cover the overhead, couldn't cover the system, so it would collapse. And that's the point. The point is to destroy it because they're oil hoes. They are in the pockets of the oil industry. Simple. How is there any debating that?
Absolutely not. You know, you and I have been to D.C., what, numerous times? They have one of the best subway systems in the country. And my point is this. When you have public transportation that works, people use it. Many people don't even drive their own cars. They only use your cars to drive out of D.C. In D.C., they use public transportation, and it works fine. I recently talked to someone who lived in Europe, and they said when I came here, I was absolutely appalled at the railroad system we have. Some of the countries in Europe are literally decades ahead of us. And they have excellent rail systems, and they're not relying on oil. And the only thing preventing us from doing that here, Rick, is political will.
And you look at the thing that they want to do in California. They wanted to connect pretty much the whole state of California, San Francisco to Los Angeles. They wanted to do that in the worst way, and then down to, you know, San Diego, connect the whole state to where you could jump on high speed rail and you go anywhere in the state. And you know, it's a great idea. It's going to get people off the highways. It's going to clear up some congestion. Smart thing. Well, what's going on is the Republicans have taken some money out of the budget. They've taken some commitments away. And what's happening now is now they've got to start looking at shortening the initial plan. So, you know, what they're doing is starving the beast. So what was to be a big grand plan that was going to affect real change, now we're going to have to start thinking on a very small scale. And then they're going to turn back and say, see, it didn't work. If you remember back, during 2009, the stimulus discussion, Congress approved some $10.5 billion for high speed rail. Well, when the Republicans took over, they rescinded $400 million of it. California was their plan. This grand idea from San Francisco all the way down to Southern California by 2020 was to have this high speed system set up. And they were planning on about a $45 billion investment. Think of how many jobs that is. Mm-hmm. How many tens of thousands of jobs, good paying jobs. Now they're going, well, gee, you know, we were expecting about a third of that money to come from the feds. That was what was being discussed. Now they're only going to get about $3 billion from the feds. So if your plan is $45 billion for this big project and you're expecting $15 billion from the feds and you only get $3 billion, what happens to your plan? Well, it's going to do what we know it's going to do. It is going to shrink. And, again, who wins? The oil industry.
If you remember, Rick, in Ohio and in Florida, both those governors.
And
why
Wisconsin.
Would you do that? Yeah, they had a big project that was going to dramatically enhance the abilities of people to move around the state, dramatically enhance the economic climate, and create tens of thousands of jobs. And because of political ideology, they refused and they canceled it. On so many levels, it makes no sense.
Sure it does. It makes perfect sense. We need to feed the wealth class and their oil habit. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Kathleen Sharp, author of Blood Feud, the man who blew the whistle on one of the deadliest prescription drugs ever, and also her piece, Anatomy of a $30 Billion Medicare Crime. Stick around. You're not going to want to miss this. Back. Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated, professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, you can download our podcast there. If you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go with you. You know, last week we were talking about some of the Medicare abuses, some of the fraud, some of the, you know, just the nonsense that's been going on where I think you can crack down. There's an opportunity. But for me, it's the drug portion, the fact that we don't negotiate for prescription drugs. And you got to wonder if some of them work. That's the question I've had for quite some time. Anyway, that's why I've asked Kathleen Sharp. She's the author of Blood Feud, the man who blew the whistle on one of the deadliest prescription drugs ever. She also wrote a piece, Anatomy of a $30 Billion Medicare Crime, for the folks over at Truth Out. You can see that over at truthout.org. Kathleen, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, well, it's lovely to be here.
You know, I look at some of this stuff and all the money that goes into Medicare and all the scheming that goes on to try and strip it away. It's not surprising we see folks who are cheating the system and drug companies doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's pretty much business as usual for a lot of pharmaceuticals. But I think that now that Medicare is on the block, there's a lot of attention being paid to this sort of gaming.
You know, I look at this and, you know, right from the beginning, I had to question the Bush years and why we can't, if we believe in free markets and we believe in competition, you know, why can't we negotiate for drug prices?
Well, that's a great, point. And I think the Bush drug coverage for Medicare has been described as the most reckless fiscal plan ever in the history of the Republic. It adds something like $13 trillion to entitlement costs. And, you know, there's no reason why we can't negotiate for volume discounts just like other companies and HMOs do. It's really ridiculous.
It is ridiculous, especially for the drugs that work. Tell me about this story, Anatomy of a $30 billion Medicare crime. As I'm looking at it, this anti-anemia drug Procrit seems to be the culprit.
Well, yeah, this was really wonderful of me to kind of boil it down for Truth Out because it sort of lays at the heart of my book, Blood Feud. But basically what we have here is EPO. It was a miracle drug in the late 1980s. It was really the first biotech blockbuster. And all it did was multiply our blood cells, synthetically so that we didn't need to get blood transfusions.
Right.
But in the process, people gradually over, maybe a decade realized that it multiplied your red blood cells so much that your blood turned to sludge. So here your heart was trying desperately to pump all this mud through your body, and it triggered heart attacks, strokes,
so it's almost clots. Better to be anemic than it is to have sludge running through your veins.
Well, I personally would much rather be anemic. You know, I'd take my iron supplements or at least get blood transfusions. But the really scary thing about this drug is that despite the FDA's repeated request to have it be tested for safety, both Amgen, the creator of the drug, and Johnson & Johnson, who licensed it, never, ever tested it adequately for safety.
Well, I mean, couldn't you make that argument about just about any drug out on the market? We've become such a culture that there's a pill, a miracle cure, a silver bullet around every corner that all we got to do is take this pill and all of our problems, our incontinence, our old age, our hair, doesn't matter. Everything can be cured by this magic pill. And to be honest, they've all got side effects. You know, if you listen to the commercials, listen to the fast words at the end. I'll go to the bathroom a couple of times extra a day. Thanks very much.
Yeah, you're right, Rick. And I think the key here is just having all the information that the drug companies have. In this case, in Blood Feud and the Truth Out piece I did, no one really knew all of the risks. And the companies sort of hid it for many, many years from patients. So if we know the risk, we can weigh it against the rewards and then decide on our own whether or not we want to take this pill or this injection.
Yeah,
but in the case of EPO, it was, massive deception going on for years and years and years.
Yeah, but isn't that why you go to a doctor? I mean, we all can't be pharmacists. We rely on our doctor to be upfront with us and say, this is going to be good for you. It's not going to be good for you. Isn't that where the doctor is? So is part of this fraud, if you will, this crime, partly the doctor's responsibility as well?
Well, absolutely it is. What a lot of us don't know is that our doctors, especially with injectable drugs, they earn money on the spread between what they can bill Medicare and what they actually pay for the bill, for the drug itself. So that's the rub, is that our doctors, at least in the case of EPO, many oncologists were in on the game. They were making $100,000, $150,000 a year on, overbilling Medicare, Medicaid, and some insurance companies and pocketing the difference. Some doctors actually got free drugs and went ahead and billed the government for, this dubious medicine.
And they keep telling me that Obamacare is going to be worse than what we've gotten and going to be more costly. I can't imagine. For me, I look at this, Kathleen, and, this is what happens in my mind when you have a for-profit system where you create billionaires out of our medical system.
Yeah, it does not. I mean, there are some things that you really shouldn't turn a profit on. One of them is children, and another one is health. And that's why I think, and perhaps you'll agree with me, that single payer really makes a lot of sense, because you're cutting out the middleman.
Well, you're cutting out. I think it should go back to the way it was. It was a not-for-profit endeavor. In fact, we the people, we had community hospitals that we owned collectively, and we paid the bill because we needed the treatment.
I totally agree. And you know what else was really interesting in this, Rick, is that I uncovered this little nugget that government, whether it's at the local level or at the federal level, already pays for 60% of all insured Americans. You know, whether that's teachers or policemen or firefighters or politicians or the elderly. So why not turn it into 100%?
Yeah, well, and you know, what I've always said is, look, there should be a baseline. We should all have, you know, basic care that if I have cancer or have a heart attack, I'm not going to go broke. I'm not going to lose my house. I'm not going to go bankrupt. And if I want the extras, I want plastic surgery, I want, you know, quicker knee replacements, I can buy that in the private market. But as a baseline, we should all have, you know, basic care.
We absolutely should. And we really should have enforcement, you know, of the laws that we have, the anti-kickback laws or the false claims, whistleblowing law. What was really shocking to me, another thing, I mean, so many shocking things I found in this Truth Out piece and also Blood Feud, is that the Department of Justice, you know, who's supposed to be the big cop on the beat, does not pursue a lot of these fraud cases, and they let the whistleblowers, string themselves out for years and years and years in federal court, and they have to go up against these $800 and $900 attorneys that the pharmaceutical companies hire.
Yep.
So it's really a stacked deck against not only the whistleblowers, but they're trying to blow the whistle on behalf of all taxpayers, so we lose too.
Yeah, and I was just reading something the other day that the Republicans are now trying to push to cut the amount that whistleblowers receive for reporting things like, you know, some of these that you point out in your book Blood Feud and in the truthout.org article Anatomy of a $30 billion Medicare crime, that they want to slash those payments and de-incentivize anybody coming forward.
Well, if they restrict the payouts for whistleblowers, then they have to restrict what pharmaceuticals make on us.
Yeah, that's not, we both know. We both know, Kathleen, that is never going to happen.
Well, fair's fair. You know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
So, you know, we've been seeing some of these things, and we all know this stuff's going on. How do we stop it? How do we turn this thing around?
Boy, that's a great point. I would say we really need to agitate, you know, for single payer. For some reason, it's totally out of the national conversation now. Even though 2 years ago when Obama was talking about health care reform, many Americans were urging the administration to go for that. So I think we have to raise our voices again. Also, you see so much great work with the unions, the Teamsters, on this whole Occupy Wall Street where we are all so sick and tired of corporate greed trumping human need. And, boy, there's no better example than the healthcare system where, you know, all of us feel like ATMs who are sort of cashing out for all the private enterprises.
Yeah, and again, you know, this is one of those things that I do believe, and I know most people that I know don't believe it should be a right, but healthcare should be one of those rights. If I've got the right to an attorney when I get into trouble, I should have a right to a doctor when I get sick.
Well, you look at other countries where that is a right, you know, and you see that they're far more productive societies, whether they're Scandinavian countries or European countries. Their children are happier and healthier. There's not such a huge income disparity. And basically, they are brighter, happier, richer nations, really. And it really does pay for all of us to lift one another's boats because we're all in this together.
Yeah, and looking at this in comparison to your book, in other countries, do they have the same kind of medical, the same kind of drug system that we have where you have, basically billion-dollar drug companies dictating law and basically putting out any drug they want and marketing it to their people like it's soda or tennis shoes or any product that's going to enhance your existence?
No, there's some more safeguards in European countries than there are here in the United States. And actually, I mean, you don't have the lobbying that Amgen or the pharmaceuticals have. There's an enormous amount of money and pressure on our Congress and political leaders to pass laws that really hurt sort of the general welfare. And in Europe, it's not such a profit system over there. And it was so interesting because EPO here, you know, turned into way, way, way oversubscribed, overprescribed, and people were dying, you know, in large numbers. Whereas in Europe, it was used a lot more moderately because doctors couldn't make, you know, a dime really off of that medicine.
Yeah, I look at Billy Townsend and most people, a congressman that they've never heard of, a small, you know, basically a nobody from Louisiana, quits Congress after pushing through Bush's drug bill to become, you know, the head lobbyist for Big Pharma at a salary of somewhere around 8 to 10 times what he was making working for Congress.
Yeah,
that should be, is that a crime in other places?
The conflict of interest? I can't speak to that, but it is a crime here. It really is. Just common sense tells you that.
Yeah, it should be an absolute crime, something we should be locking people up for. But here again, this guy did it. You know, he pushed through that vote, and then within a couple of days, I'm going to resign.
Yeah. And even at the FDA, you see some of the, you know, in Blood Feud, as I point out, you see some of the pharmaceutical attorneys suddenly putting away their white shoes and then becoming attorneys for the FDA, where they stop any sort of reprimand that the FDA might give out to Johnson & Johnson and Amgen. We saw this time and time again, or even look at the Department of Justice, where Eric Holder, who used to be a very well-paid attorney at Covington and Burling, which, of course, is the defense for Johnson & Johnson,
right.
And now he's deciding which whistleblower cases will go forward. So it's sort of no surprise, I think, that the whistleblowing case against Johnson & Johnson is stuck somewhere without Eric Holder's assistance.
Yeah, and you look at the swinging door, it's all the industries. They put their insiders in. They put their well-paid folks in for a couple of years, go do our bidding, come back, nice lucrative gig.
Yeah, and that's why I think clean money, you know, this whole clean money campaign really is important, because once you take the money out of government, I think you'll see less and less of this.
Yeah, and once we reclaim our medical system and we reclaim our health care, maybe that as well. Anyway, the book is Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Also, the Truth Out piece, Anatomy of a $30 Billion Medicare Crime. We've also got that link. Just click on Kathleen Sharp. Click on her name. It'll take you right there. Kathleen, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Just get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
My name is Toya. I'm a sales rep, and I work for Capital Blue Cross.
If you're choosing Medicare coverage, Toya will meet you anywhere to help you decide.
I met him at food courts, diners, the parks, on a bench. And today, we're meeting at airport.
Mike was a Navy service person, an engineer, and a pilot.
I'm a senior blue EPO member.
He is technically retired.
I'm a gray-haired teenager.
Mike appreciates the visit.
It's more personal, and you can talk easier. He can show emotion, which you can't over the telephone, and it's more caring.
Toya would agree.
I love my customers. I really, really do. My main objective is to show them that I care. When you care more, you do more.
For customer service, call 1-888-340-3978, Monday through Friday, 8 to 8, with extended hours October 15th through February 14th. Senior Blue PPO is issued by Capital Advantage Insurance Company, a Medicare Advantage organization with a Medicare contract. Capital Blue Cross and Capital Advantage Insurance Company are independent licensees of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Like things are kind of upside down, choking you someone to turn around. Done it before. Hurricane's coming to town like a hurricane.
Herman Cain train. I don't know what it is, but his popularity continues to rise. According to a new poll from Zogby International, the Pizza Man is delivering. His latest poll numbers 45%, a 7% increase, a 7-point increase over the October 5th survey. He has more than doubled the second place Mitt Romney, who has 21%. And, well, nobody else is in double digits. You know, no Rick Perry, no Michelle Bachmann, no Newt Gingrich, none of them. So it looks like, you know, it looks like the Pizza Man on top for now, and Romney coming up and everybody else, well, way, way, way back in the polls. And I don't know if you saw it this weekend on Meet the Depressed, with David Gregory. He was out there saying, you know, those liberals, they want to destroy the country. They hate America. They don't believe in a stronger America. And again, you know, here's a guy who wants to privatize Social Security, wants to take us down this road that would really cause our, well, cause our national debt to just completely explode. I mean, if you look at this 999 tax plan, which may be a great sales pitch, but his privatization of health care is just horrible. And you're gonna, what gets me is he likes the Chilean model. Set up by a dictator. We like the Chilean model because everyone has their own personal accounts. They can use their ATM cards and get into their retirement and take their retirement out anytime they want. So they have instant access to cash. It's kind of scary if you think about it. It's just nuts, Jake. And you look at this economy, how many people would have drained their savings by now? They absolutely would have. New poll out also, according to the Siena Research poll, 72% of New Yorkers, they say they support a millionaire's tax. Pretty simple. 83% of Democrats, 70% of independents, and 55% of Republicans support taxing the very wealthy. Now in the state, you know, what's about to expire is this millionaire surtax, which the Democratic governor opposes. He seems to think that, well, we should let the White House, we should let the federal government take that on because, oh, it's going to hurt us. Personally, I favor both. The state of New York needs revenue. The federal government needs revenue for separate reasons. And look, the very wealthy have really dominated the economic pie. And you look right now, the IMF is saying that we are the most unequal country in the world, even more unequal than the Ivory Coast, even more unequal than Ethiopia and Pakistan. They say since 1979, the gap in after-tax income between the richest 1% of Americans and the middle and poorest fifth of the country has more than tripled. So right before your very eyes, what we're seeing? Two Americas, the very, very wealthy, and the not so much, and the poverty class. And if you remember Eric Cantor, who said, well, you know, those people out on the streets, they're just growing mobs. Now, amazingly, he's had a come to Jesus moment, and he agrees. There's too much income disparity in the country. There is, you know. He was on TV this weekend with Chris Wallace, and he said, quote, we know in this country there is a complaint on the folks on the top end of the income scale that they make too much, and folks on the end don't make enough. He said we need to encourage those in the top income scale to create more jobs. No duh. And I got to be honest, I thought, part of me thought, and sorry, I'm thinking, but I thought that's why we were cutting taxes so dramatically. I thought that's why we had these drastic tax cuts and all this deregulation and all of this stuff to kind of entice the investor class to, oh, I don't know, maybe create a job. Maybe that's why, isn't that the reason we gave them all that? And in giving that, what happened? CEO pay skyrocketed 27% this year. Where's your pay gone? Most people, country as a whole, seen their income drop by 2%. Profits through the roof. Corporate America sitting on trillions of dollars that they won't use. Why not? Because no one's making them. We need to tax them. You know, this, I was reading an article this weekend, and my wife cuts out articles for me, and it was talking about advertising in the schools. It was pointing to New Jersey, who's now putting plastering advertisements on every bus. It was talking about schools who put ads in their classrooms. It was, you know, it was just talking about how we're selling out our students. And I'm going, why? Why are we doing this? Well, we need money to help fund the schools. So we're selling our children's souls so that they'll have an opportunity at education? And I guess that's the reason. And I'm asking, why aren't we just saying, you know what? We need an education system. You, corporate America, you're paying for it. And we're taking it. We're not giving you advertising. We're not going to let you fry our children's brains with your nonsense so they buy into the 999 plan. It's nuts. So Cantor went on to say more. He said, you know, Republicans, he said, we're about income mobility. And that's what we should be focused on, taking care of the income disparity. And how are we going to do that? More Bush handouts? More Bush-style handouts to the ultra-wealthy? You know, maybe we could raise revenue off the backs of the 47% who they claim pay no federal taxes. Anyway, mark your calendar. Cantor is going to give a speech on income inequality on Friday. And boy, I just can't wait for this. And according to one of his aides, he's going to focus specifically on how Washington can help a single mom, a small business owner, and how we make sure that the people at the top, I don't make this up, how the people at the top can stay there. Oh, my goodness. Corporate profits continue to rise. Yep. Wells Fargo just announced, I don't know if you saw these numbers, third quarter earnings jumped 21%, $4.1 billion in profit. Citigroup, third quarter earnings rose 73%, $3.8 billion profit. JP Morgan Chase, earnings were off. They only pocketed $3 billion in profits. It was a tough quarter, tough third quarter. I mean, you look at this and you go, corporate America's doing great. They're fabulous. Profits as a share of GDP higher than they've been at any point since 1950. I mean, that whole song, Happy Days Are Here Again? Yeah. So how are things in your neck of the woods? Judge, no jobs. In fact, it's going to cost us jobs. And they're going to buy back shares of their companies, and they're going to enrich themselves and basically divvy it up against amongst their little group, peer group. So what we're doing then is we're giving out more handouts to multinationals. And do we need that? Is that something we need more of? Is this how we grow the economy? Double down on the same failed policies that got us into the mess that we're in? Do we get rid of the capital gains tax? See, this would be a really just a boom. We get rid of the capital gains tax. We let them bring all that repatriated money back, and they could sit on not just $2 or $3 trillion, but $5 or $6. Do we need the 999? I mean, Herman Cain, I don't know if you've heard Hermie lately, but that's the only thing that comes out of his mouth. And if you look at Hermie's plan, Hermie said, you know, of the Buffett rule, that if it's not class warfare, it's highway robbery. He says, pick my pockets, because that's what he's doing. That's what the Buffett plan is. But if you look at the Hermie plan, the 999, under the 999, Buffett pays nothing. According to an analysis prepared for Yahoo News and the Lookout by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, at most, Buffett would pay 1% of his income. And you leave in those charitable deductions, Buffett would pay nothing. According to Yahoo's Zachary Roth, if Buffett thinks he's getting off easy under the current tax system, he should try life under the Cain plan. Then he'd be really complaining. Now look, Buffett made somewhere near $63 million in his haul last year. If I remember the numbers, his taxable income was somewhere around $39 million, and he paid, what was it? I think he paid $7 million or something like that in taxes. Under the Cain plan, only 4.9% of his money would be taxable. So then you take that, charitable deductions, whatever, breaks it right down. He'd pay virtually nothing. You and me, however, we we would pay considerably more. Throw that 9% sales tax in there, throw that 9% income tax in there, and you and I, we're going to be footing the bill. And you know what? The Herman Cain train, he came clean this weekend, admitting that, yeah, there'll be some people who pay more. Sure, yeah, yeah. I'm waiting for him to come out and admit that Buffett will pay nothing. I wonder if we'll get that admission out of him. Do you think? Anything? Yeah, I doubt it, too. But at the end of this, it is a huge handout, and it's not going to pass. It's a sales gimmick. And what I find amazing is Grover Norquist. You got to love Grover. The powerful man, most powerful man in Pennsylvania. He said, I'm very concerned about three different taxes. Every one of them can grow. He said, to put tapeworms in your tummy to try and maintain your weight. They may have their own idea about growth patterns and what they want to do. Creating new taxes is a very dangerous project. So to him, the Cain plan, kind of like tapeworms. But here again, I mean, if you look at this, honestly and truthfully, and, you know, Cain was on TV saying, well, you know, Americans, they just don't want to try anything new. I would like to believe that Americans just don't want to try anything dumb. That's the part that gets me. It's you know, a numbers person, I learned basic third grade math. Did you learn basic third grade math?
Yes, I did.
If the addition just doesn't add up, you can't do it. I'm sorry, it's pretty simple, and all the numbers, no matter how you slice them, no matter how you look at them, which mirror you put a position them on, we end up in massive, massive debt. It cuts the revenue into the federal government by more than half. Not my numbers, this is reality. And it's pretty simple to figure out how this would work. Now, you know, what it does do is it creates a very large, even larger investor class. The billionaire class would grow quite happily. And I like what Michael Edinger said. He said that the Cain plan would be the biggest tax shift from the wealthy to the middle class in the history of taxation ever, anywhere, and it would bankrupt the country. So you want to talk about redistributing wealth? Here it is, man. Massive. Massive redistribution. And you know what's funny? The Tea Party support this guy. How are you going to cut my taxes? You dim-witted puddle brain flag monkey. It's just, hello? Anybody? Is there anything going on in those tea brains? Anything? A thought? Something? Evidently not. I don't know if you saw the story about Rick Santorum, our boy Tricky Ricky, back in the news. Evidently, he was on the American Family Association's radio show. Good God, fair and right-wing Christian group. He said, quote, look at the political base of the Democratic Party. It's single mothers who run a household. Did you know that you're in a party with all single mothers? Did you know that? I didn't know that I belonged to a party that just had single mothers in it. Kind of interesting. He says, you know, why? Why is that? Because it's so tough economically that they look to the government for help, and therefore they're going to vote. So if you want to reduce the Democratic advantage, what you want to do is build two-parent families to eliminate that desire for government. That desire for government. You know, like milk for infants. You know, like basic staples so children have something to eat. You know, that pesky stuff, that desire for government. I'm amazed at Mr. Family Values. He says you can't have limited government and you can't have a wealthy society if the family breaks down, that basic unit of society. And I go, you know, if he's so interested in that basic unit, why is he so obsessed with if two men or two women want to recreate that unit that he's so proud of? So I don't know if you saw it this weekend, but Herman Cain told Meet the Depress's David Gregory that he would not seek a constitutional ban of same-sex marriage. His basic premise is, look, a states' rights guy, let the states do it. So Tricky Ricky, not happy. He fired off a statement characterizing marriage equality as a moral wrong akin to slavery. I find that kind of interesting. Looking at the Herman Cain train, he says, I have been a long-time advocate of states' rights. However, I believe, as Abraham Lincoln did, that states don't have the right to legalize moral wrongs. So he pokes his finger at Cain and Bachman and Rick Perry, who all believe that each of the states should have their own definition of marriage. And he says, I strongly disagree, and I will continue to fight for traditional marriage between one man and one woman, said the frothy one. And, you know, I look at this and I go, you know, this whole states' rights argument, you listen to the Bachmans and the Keynes, and they're pretty steadfast on it. You know, and you got to give them credit. They have their ideology at states' rights. Santorum, he tries to walk that line until the authoritarian part of him comes out. Is anybody concerned? I know I am. But here again, don't we have jobs to create? Don't we need infrastructure? Don't we need things other than all of this talk of gay marriage, which is all Santorum's got to run on? I wish someone would smack him and tell him to sit down. I mean, just once, just a good backhand, wipe that smug look off his face.
Rick Santorum has very little chance of winning this. By all accounts, he hasn't raised a lot of money. I think what he's doing is he's looking for an issue whenever he has one, and here he saw a chance of going after someone who's ascending, and so he took a poke at him. I mean, if you want to talk about states' rights, we can go back to, equal but separate. Does that ring a bell?
Separate but equal.
Are we gonna fight the fight that we fought 60 years ago?
According to the frothy one, yes. Yes, and I like the way you put that. He was poking at them. Very, very interesting choice of language there.
That's about all he has left, really. Well, take a pot shot. You can call it what you want. That's pretty much. And let's be honest. I mean, the Cain train is moving on up the track pretty well. They're trying to derail it.
So today, in fact, you know, within the last hour or so, I guess, Michelle Bachman hosted a teletown hall with none other than the hair master himself, Donald Trump. I'm not sure if the Barber King there was able to muster an endorsement, which at this point, what is the point? What's the point of even getting involved? And I got to be honest, I'm not even sure why I brought up Michelle Bachman. It's twice in a show, and that's twice too many, because her chances, well, they're well down. They got run over on the tracks by the Herman Cain train, which, again, you know, you got to love the guy. I find him funny. I find him interesting. But I find him dangerous. And we end up with this, with the pizza man in the White House. You may never get to buy a pizza again. This economy, based on what he's talking about, right back to the 90s, the 1890s. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. I'm going to talk with Malin Mitchell of the Professional Firefighters of Wisconsin back after this.
USA and resume the ties that bind. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job and join the people.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
If you had any doubt about the seriousness of the Occupy Wall Street movement that's springing up from America's grassroots like hardy wildflowers, just note the frantic fulminations against it by assorted Wall Street toadies. The corporate cheerleaders on CNBC, for example, reached back to the nasty days of McCarthyism to smear the youthful protesters as, quote, aligned with Lenin. Little Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, who loyally serves the banksters as their Washington lapdog, yapped in alarm about the growing mobs occupying Wall Street. Then came Mitt Romney, himself a former Wall Streeter, to warn darkly against the protesting rabble, "I think it's dangerous, this class warfare." Even more clueless is Herman Cain.
Previously the CEO of Godfather's Pizza Chain, who's now running for president, he can't stop foaming at the mouth about the Wall Street occupation. Anti-American, he labeled the protesters, later blasting them as losers who are jealous of successful people. Don't blame Wall Street, he lectured. If you don't have a job and you're not rich, blame yourself. To put the icing on his half-baked cupcake of ignorance, Cain then expressed his deep understanding of economics. To protest Wall Street and the bankers is basically saying you're anti-capitalism, he expounded. A plutocratic theory that America's millions of conservative small business capitalists would consider perverse. But wait, there are more Keynesians. These demonstrations, he complained, I honestly don't understand. What are they looking for? This is Jim Hightower saying, gosh, Godfather, if you have to ask a question like that, you're way too out of touch to be president. What we're looking for are such old-fashioned American fundamentals, by which I mean economic fairness, social justice, and equal opportunities for all. That's what America stands for.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The right to bargain is the right that's fundamentally about power to the people. That's where it should be. It's called justice. It's called democracy. So hear this, Scott Walker, because your time is limited. Let us tell you what your big problem really is. It ain't your nagging, finger wagging, budget deficit. The problem lies with your moral deficit.
Well, you know, interesting point there is moral deficit. You know, we were in Wisconsin back in February. We were in Ohio. We're here in the first part of November. We're going to be back in Ohio for the SB5 election issue number two. We may be back in Wisconsin again with the recall of Scott Walker, and that's something that's going on, I guess, as we speak. And one of the people on the front end of this is Malin Mitchell. He's the president of the Professional Firefighters of Wisconsin Union. Malin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, good to be on again. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming back. Really exciting times out there. You guys got to recall two Republicans in heavily Republican areas, and now potentially the guy who caused all this problem. Maybe you can get him out as well.
Yeah, we got a recall of the governor coming up here. Petition signing signatures will start November 15th. And from that point, we got 60 days to get 548,206 signatures. They're shooting for around 700,000 signatures because a lot of them have to be verified.
Right.
And hopefully to have an election in at the end of April to recall our governor and take our state back.
Yeah, you can use a lot of the same infrastructure you built, getting rid of a couple of the senators there and building in those other districts where you came up a little short. So you might have a good start there. But at the end of this, isn't this going to be a huge money campaign? Because as I understand, there are no caps on your elections during this.
Yeah, Governor Walker can raise as much money as he damn well pleases. He can raise. We're thinking between $50 to $70 million he will raise. There are no restrictions on the amount of money. Once we actually start deciding November 15th, he can raise any amount of money he wants. And obviously we know there's going to be a lot of outside money, a lot of outside interest that comes from that. Because there's a lot of people, believe it or not, I mean, it's nice to go around the state and talk to people that don't necessarily agree with Governor Walker, but there are a lot of people that agree with Governor Walker. And not a lot in our state, but there's a plenty outside of our state. We have the Koch brothers. We have Alex. I mean, we have a lot of people that want to funnel money into this campaign, so we're going to be in for a fight. It's not going to be easy at all.
No, I mean, you mentioned the Koch brothers and the entire billionaire class, because that's really the epicenter of the attack on workers' rights and the attack on collective bargaining rights. And if he's able to stand and the policies that he rammed through like a thief in the night are able to be upheld, that's just going to give more, that's going to embolden people like Tom Corbett here and Kasich in Ohio and other right-wing governors across the country.
Yeah, there's no doubt. There's a lot of weight on our shoulders as there was with the original recall. I mean, this came out, we were originally the first to come out and stand up against this, and we stood up in a big way, a lot of pushback from labor. But you're right, if we do lose this, I hate to say it, but there'll be credence to his argument that he is helping with job creation, so to speak, being a fiscal conservative, but balancing the budgets on the backs of firefighters, police officers, janitors, snowplow drivers, nurses is not the way to go. And that's our message. I mean, we can have a pretty clear and distinct message as to what we want in our state. And the attack on the middle class is not it.
Yeah, you know, I was just reading a report from UC Berkeley. They were talking about the fact that this whole right wing argument that it's the public sector who's destroying the budgets, and that's just plain false. They're saying it's the housing bubble and Wall Street that brought us down. And I look at all these right wing governors across the country. You know, to me, it looks very Machiavellian. It's taking your opponents out in square and gutting them in public. And I look at union members and I ask, you know, like here in Pennsylvania, 51% of union members voted for Pat Toomey, the Republican. How many union members in Wisconsin voted for Walker? And, you know, how sorry are they now? And how will they vote in the future?
Well, we had 39.6% of union members around our state voted for Governor Walker. 39.6%. And that's a disgrace. And that, in all honesty, that's embarrassing. Because we were asleep at the wheel, so to speak. But we have been energized and we have arisen. We should never have been asleep, but we have arisen. So the Wisconsin uprising is not going to stop. I think you've seen it go not just in Wisconsin. Obviously you see it in Ohio. You see it in Florida. You see it in New York. You definitely see it in Indiana. But we're not going to stop. And now that's why you're seeing Occupy Wall Street. We're not going to sit idly by and let this, what I call the communism of millionaires, take over the United States of America. And it's wrong. But my fight here is in the state of Wisconsin. I can tell you that this is not a fight that we started, but I guarantee you we're going to definitely finish it. We're going to keep fighting. And that's what we're doing right now. We're going to keep fighting the government that is having these draconian measures that's taken away, that's stripping the rights of the workers and the people that we call now with the senseless rhetoric of shared sacrifice and job creation. Now we call these rich and wealthy job creators. I mean, we got to stop it. Back in the 19th century, they called them robber barons. So we're going to change the course of our state, the state of Wisconsin. And it's not going to be just a movement. It's got to be a way of life. And we have to keep up the pressure and continue this fight and continue this uprising.
You know, I've been looking at some of the names being thrown out, and you sound like someone quite articulate, quite passionate, and I think that's what the folks in Wisconsin need, someone willing to stand up and fight back and smack somebody in the mouth when necessary.
I agree, and we need a new type of politics in our state. We need a new type of politics and a new type of candidate in the entire United States, but we're going to find a candidate that can come out and tell like it is, talk straight to the citizens of the state of Wisconsin, and tell them what they're going to do. The problem with what's happening in our state right now is the electorate feels like they've been duped, so to speak, because the governor never talked about taking collective bargaining rights. He talked about being fiscally conservative, job creation. And right now, this is the month of October, the end of October almost, and we're just starting to get a special session for job creation. Well, we need a job creation in January, right?
Yep.
But we're not going to just sit by, and labor's not going to sit by at the wheel and sleep at the wheel anymore. We're going to elect candidates that care about our issues. And when it comes to recalling the governor, we're going to make sure that we elect a candidate or at least have a candidate running against the governor that can talk openly, honestly to the citizens of the state of Wisconsin.
Absolutely. You know, one of the questions that people had when I came back were, you know, why were the firefighters involved? You know, as the president of the Professional Firefighters of Wisconsin, you know, why did you choose to get involved in this when your neck wasn't on the line? And I heard that quite often. You know, they weren't going after the cops and the firefighters. Why did they get involved?
Well, we got involved because it was the right thing to do. When firefighters see an emergency, we respond, and that's what we're doing. But we understood the divide and conquer tactic that was coming down from this current administration. And we weren't going to let that happen. I mean, to sit and tell us that we can sit idly by police and fire, and they treat everybody else so radically differently, there is no way that fire and police were going to sit by and let that happen. We could not do that. It was the wrong thing to do. We had a nervous and a painful feeling in our stomach that we had to come out openly against this, even though we were untouched, so to speak. We said no. And we not only said no, and I said before, we said hell no. But we're going to continue to fight this. We can't sit back and just let everybody else be treated differently, because this is more than just about us. This is about a middle class fight. This is more than just about union labor. This is about honoring all labor. This was just one part of the fight. There's many more things that are going to come down. And we found that out in the big budget. I mean, the cuts against for education, 30% cuts in tech colleges, almost $1 billion from K through 12 education. Child labor law weakened. If you're under 18 years of old, you can work more hours and more days of the week. There's a lot more coming down from this, it's lies and deceit that are coming down from the radical right.
Malin, everything you just ticked off there, sounds like stuff that they want to do here in Pennsylvania. Sounds like things that they wanted to do in Maine and in Ohio and in Michigan and Florida and pretty much in every one of the states where the radical right controls the process. And I've been telling people, wake up, because this isn't just Scott Walker in Wisconsin. This isn't just John Kasich. This is a conspiracy from the top. These are well thought out, well planned, well executed plays from their playbook.
Yeah, it's a well orchestrated attack. It just happened to start in Wisconsin. You know, before this, Wisconsin was just known for two things: Green Bay Packers and Chiefs. Well, now we're known for so much more than that. Unfortunately, and it's an unfortunate set of circumstances. I mean, I love being on your show, but it's an unfortunate set of circumstances that you know who I am.
Yep.
Because of what came out of Wisconsin.
Yep.
And it's not something I want to be braggadocious about. We have to stop it.
I agree.
The problem is, like you talked about before, you had so many members vote for your governor in Pennsylvania. Well, we had almost 40% of our members vote for Governor Walker. Well, in Ohio, firefighters and police officers backed Governor Kasich. So we have to wake up. We have to look in the mirror and make sure that we can police ourselves before we tell others how to vote. So we got to make sure we educate our membership. I think one problem with the unions is that we went to a point of servicing our members as opposed to educating, mobilizing, and galvanizing our members to know what the issues are. Well, this has definitely made us wake up.
And I hope it's a lesson hard learned, but I'm hoping it's something that that continues, because the education process is something that I think this Occupy Wall Street and the occupations all across the country, there's opportunity to talk to those folks as well. Last question I've got for you, Malin. You know, I see that there's some John Doe investigation going on. Any new developments that you know of? Because there's part of me that hopes that he's out before anything happens.
Well, the John Doe investigation is getting a lot closer to the governor's office. There are people in his current cabinet that have been granted immunity. I think there's 11 total, and I don't want to be misquoted here, but I think there's three or four that in the current administration, the entire state, that he has appointed that have been granted immunity. So I think it's getting closer and closer. But John Doe investigations, as you know probably better than I do, take time, and that's the FBI working. So we're not hanging our hat on that. But we are hanging our hat on making sure that the state of Wisconsin and the citizens of Wisconsin know what's happening and educating on the issues and let them know that this is not just a union fight, but it's a middle-class fight. But the John Doe investigation is definitely something that has been looked at, as well as you may have read in the past couple of days, where the governor has not paid, like his campaign promised said, that he would pay the 5.9% of his pension. He has not done that until it's legally bounding in August. So a lot of misconception here, a lot of things that we just did not know that was going to come from this governor. But now we know, and now we have to act.
And I'm hoping that happens. I wish you guys the best. I hope you'll come back and tell us if there are any big announcements or if there's anything that we can do to help. Always great to talk to you, Malin.
Well, if I have a big announcement, you'll be the first to know.
I appreciate that. Malin Mitchell, professional firefighters of Wisconsin. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK. Stick around. We're right back.
So desperate measures we explore, marching on the Capitol to lobby leaders for involvement. 3,000 people screaming out,
"Where's our government?"
Lawsuits and arraignments, members under company surveillance. Public divided, even they love us, all they hate us. Profit billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have put into a cap.
That'll be never give up.
We'll be here one day longer. The people's voice is stronger.
The people's voice is stronger.
We heard hardcore money, we will talk and respect. Keep fighting for these rights for generations, it's next. One day longer.
The people's
voice is stronger. Working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
One day longer.
washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and abroad, Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you.
Some news coming out of the Supreme Court?
Yes, a couple things happening. One is the court's going to review the Stolen Valor Act. A lower court in an appellate court in the Ninth Circuit, 2-1 voted that it was the Stolen Valor Act essentially was not something that was essentially it did not defy laws. And the Supreme Court is going to be taking it up to see whether it does defy law.
So what is the Stolen Valor Act?
Essentially, if you use somebody's Purple Heart and say you got a Purple Heart and you didn't, Congress has now made that a crime.
Well, it shouldn't be a crime. It should be a beating. I'm in favor of, you know, like my grandfather always said, the quickest way to make a citizen out of somebody is a good slap upside the back of the head. And I think, you know, that's a good way of maybe starting that. Just my opinion. What else is the Supreme Court working on?
Okay, so the other thing they're doing is the Oneida Nation, they said, does not have a claim to being underpaid for 250,000 acres that were taken from them in the 1800s and 1900s, or 1700s and 1800s, sorry. They said that they were underpaid for that. Supreme Court backed up a lower court on that one. And also the Supreme Court on the Royal Dutch Shell in Nigeria said that they are going to be taking a look. Can a claim be held against a corporation? Lower court said it could not be, so the Supreme Court is going to be taking a look at that.
Well, we know which way that's going to go.
Yeah,
No claims against corporations. But
that's right.
On the Indian thing, on the Oneida Nation thing, you mean influenza wasn't good enough? I mean, those blankets that we gave them with the influenza, that wasn't payment enough? No?
Right.
No, not really. All right. Anyway, I guess a big bus tour coming up, going.
Well,
the president,
he started his bus tour today, and on this bus tour, he said that there was going to be $35 billion that they want to put towards hiring teachers, firefighters, and police. Tomorrow he's going to be doing a bus tour in Jamestown, South Carolina, and then going on to Virginia. And what's fascinating about this is that American Crossroads, Karl Rove's group, is going to run ads with clips of Bill Clinton saying there shouldn't be any taxes taken from, like, 10 years ago, an increase in taxes in media markets along the bus tour.
Sure. I mean, the money has to follow the tour, and Karl Rove's group is flush in cash. The billionaire classes has made sure his coffers are filled, so he can do things like this. He can shill for them. Because, you know, we don't need more firemen, and we don't need teachers. I'm sure the people in Wall Street, you know, the folks protesting might have a different say on the cops, but that's a whole another argument for another day.
That's right.
So what are we talking about on the jobs issue? I mean, you know, at the end of this.
What they're trying to do on this, they sort of have a two-pronged approach. On one hand, they're going to try and, you know, pass it a little bit at a time in the Senate. And the other thing is that the Interior and Transportation Departments are sort of starting their own jobs program. Transportation Department is giving out contracts for sort of shovel-ready kinds of projects that they have in their budget. The Interior Department is trying to beef up the parks and try and create more visitors to it, trying to figure out a way to get more people to take part in our natural resources in that way. They say that could create 3.3 million jobs if you look at the jobs downstream that would come from that hotel industry, that kind of thing.
You know what would spark, you know, the parks thing and the hotel industry and all of that tourism stuff? You know what would spark that?
What would do that?
People who have vacation.
Yeah, oh, that's a good point.
You know, it'd be
I guess
nice.
Radio people would not be part of those folks.
Exactly, but it would be nice. And a lot of the people that I've talked to with the occupations going on around here, a lot of people don't have vacation. A lot of people don't have sick days. A lot of people being underpaid. And then, you know, there's this frame going out that the people who are in these occupations are unemployed. Not true. A good majority of the people that I've met are employed. In fact, they have two, three, four jobs with no sick days, no days off, no vacations. So vacations would be a good way to start. Maybe like the Germans do. Start off with day one, 30 days vacation.
Wouldn't that be nice?
That's a pipe dream here.
And
but,
that would allow us to spend a little more family time, things like that.
And you would think the party of family values, you know, the people who keep throwing that in our face that, you know, we believe in family, people like Rick Santorum would be for vacations for families to be able to, oh, I don't know, connect and be a family. Just a thought. Just throwing it out. Lastly, here in Pennsylvania, I don't know if you know, but a couple of the Republicans here, the good family values, Christian people, they want to make sure that I can have liquor anytime I want and easily at my disposal right next to the Tic Tacs on the counter. We're actually looking at privatizing our state stores so that, again, you know, liquor everywhere. We can have a liquor store like Washington, D.C., a liquor store on almost every corner.
Wow.
Some interesting numbers coming out of the CDC.
Yeah, there was a study done that they said that excessive alcohol consumption is known to kill 79,000 people in the United States each year. But a new study says that it also has an impact on our wallets. This is right from what they're saying. They said the cost of alcohol consumption in the United States has reached $223.5 billion. And that is because of people who are losing work, dying, all those kinds of things, winding up in hospitals, and work productivity, as they said, and even the criminal justice expenses, and, of course, motor vehicle crash costs.
Wow. And, yeah, 79,000 people. I mean, you know, yeah, I'm thinking what my Republican family values people must be thinking here in the state as they're trying to make sure that I have, you know, easier access to alcohol. Maybe, you know, because I look at this and I say, it's got to go higher. I mean, the more consumption you have, the more availability, the more impulse buying we do of liquor, I can only see that going higher. I've got an idea, though. I think we should make all of our stores, like our convenience stores, our supermarkets, all that, one-stop vice shopping. Turn those pharmacies into actual drug stores. You buy heroin, buy whatever you want, right from the drugstore. Get your liquor, do your gambling, all right there. Pretty simple. Just
wow.
A thought. Just a thought. I mean,
it's an interesting thought.
It is the
That's
free market.
That's why you're doing radio, because you got interesting thoughts.
It's a bad idea, but it's still a thought. Ellen Ratner, I appreciate the time. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Now to find out what's going on across the street. What do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. As has been usual the last week, another development in this ongoing saga of the city of Harrisburg and what's coming out of it. Attorneys for the Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett and the city mayor Linda Thompson will try and block the council's bankruptcy during an emergency status conference scheduled for earlier today before a federal bankruptcy judge. Meanwhile, the state Senate today could approve legislation that would allow for a takeover. Harrisburg Governor of Harrisburg, Governor Tom Corbett, has said he will, in fact, sign the legislation. Federal mediator Judge Mary France told the attorneys during the conference in Harrisburg to file a petition to dismiss the council's request. All parties objecting to the council's request must file briefs and petitions by October 28th. The state filed a petition to dismiss the council's filing on Friday. Dauphin County also plans to file a petition for dismissal, and you have several important comments that I believe are pretty telling. You have Glenn Grell, who is the chief sponsor of the bill in the House for a takeover, and he said this: best case, it gets to the governor's desk by Monday. Worst case, I think it gets to him Wednesday night. Jeff Pakola said the bankruptcy filing will not stall the takeover. And one other comment, and this is by the counsel hired by the lawyer hired by the city council, Mr. Schwartz. He said the fiscal code change means nothing and only gives the state the right to have take away certain funds from the city. He called Senate Bill 1151 illegal. If Senate Bill 1151 is approved, it goes to the Governor Corbett's office, and he has, in fact, promised to sign it. This drama keeps going on, but I think this time, I think a possible end is in sight, and whether we like it or not, it looks like probably the government takeover of Harrisburg is pretty imminent. Tax cuts for the rich have cost about $11.6 million every hour, according to a recently released study. Tax cuts for the wealthiest 5% have cost the U.S. Treasury, that's U.S. Treasury as defined by you and I, the American taxpayers, about 11.6 every hour, every day. Those figures come to us from a new report of the cost of Bush's tax cuts on taxpayers by the National Priorities Project. In total, the top 5% of wage earners live in about 1.4 million households. They earn $477,000 on average per year. Will receive an average tax cut of $66,384 in 2011. The bottom 20% of wage owners will receive an average tax cut of about $107 this year. The wealthiest 5% of Americans earn 33% of all U.S. income. Between 2001 and the current projected end of the tax cut extension, tax cuts of the wealthiest 5% will cost the U.S. Treasury about $1.184 trillion. If extended through 2021, as some lawmakers have proposed, total cost will exceed $3.2 trillion, an astronomical amount. And just imagine what we could do with those trillions of dollars to enhance the economic welfare of our country and ease the suffering of literally millions of people. Back to you, Rick.
Defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come on. In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the anti-immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest: a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours, in a hail of Winchester Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in Labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, you can forgive, but you can't forget. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.thericksmithshow.com.
You're a proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So kudos to the Senate here in the state of Pennsylvania. All of them unanimously today, they voted to pass, what is it, Senate Bill 354. Anybody who knows, here on the program, we have been bashing this whole concept of a national ID, this Real ID Act. That was rammed through during the Bush years. One of those tucked into one of those appropriations bills, one of those, oh, hey, let's just stick this in like a thief in the night, and the Republicans passed it right on through. Well, now, a bunch of states, in fact, Pennsylvania is the 16th state to vote to opt out of the federal Real ID Act. And, you know, your Senator Mike Fulmer, one of the people on the front end of this, the sponsor of the bill, this Senate Bill 354, one of the more conservative Republicans. And again, this is an opportunity to give credit where credit is due. This is something that is not Democratic, not Republican. It's not party specific. It is just right. And look, it was the Republicans who rammed it through with the help of some Democrats. But I'm hoping now we've finally put the wooden stake through the heart of the vampire known as Real ID. And our friend Andy Hoover, legislative director of the ACLU, said the Real ID will be a real nightmare for states and all license holders. The Senate did the right thing today, and hopefully, real, as Andy says, Real ID is on its deathbed. Without state participation, the program cannot function. So good. I'm happy to see that.
Mm-hmm. I think some of the Republicans, and Mike was one of them, they tend to be on some issues where we agree with them. They tend to be libertarian. This is certainly one of those times.
You know, and what bothers me is, again, you know, you make this national ID card, then you start chipping it, then you start saying, well, let's make it easier and not chip it. And I was talking to somebody today who has a friend who's a civics teacher, a government teacher in a high school locally. And she said, you know, we were talking about the book 1984. And, you know, I think you've read it. I've read it a couple of times. You know, it really seems to be the playbook. And, you know, you look at it and you go, how right this guy was some 60 years, 70 years ago. And where Orwell was completely right, this person I was talking to was saying that her friend said, you know, the one thing that Orwell got wrong is that it seems nobody cares. You know, Orwell thought, you know, people would give a rat's behind. She was telling her class that, you know, the Patriot Act gives our government the ability to break into your house and put software on your computer, put cameras and do all of this stuff. And she was like, the kids just didn't care. And I've said, you know, and I've talked to some of the people who are considerably younger, and they're brought up in a totally different world than I was, because I do believe in personal privacy. I do believe that what's in my house is mine. And I do believe in the privacy of my thoughts and the privacy of my things. This generation that's coming up today and maybe a year or two earlier, privacy is not such a big concern as it was when I was a kid. or maybe when you were a kid. And maybe I'm wrong on this, but with all the Facebook and all of the social media, everything, you're used to having everything out in the open.
Well, the neocons who were pushing this for, oh my, at least the last 15 years, they saw the perfect opportunity, 9/11. I heard local talk show host Rick, who you would think would be conservative and be opposed to it, their basic position is, I want to be safe. I want to be safe, and they don't care. Because you know why they don't care, Rick? Because they think any abuses are happening to someone else.
How is it possible that a libertarian, a right-wing neocon can look and say, I hate the government, but I want to have a government ID? I mean, that just blows my mind. It blows my mind how somebody who could say, we need limited, smaller government, but we need to have this big overarching government program. I mean, look, you'd be naive to believe that there isn't already a national ID system. Everyone's got a number. They know where you are. There's more information out there about everyone. So, you know, maybe the thought of this is just semantics. But you know who holds more information about us than our government? Private corporations. They own every website. They know everything about us. And, you know, you look at some of these movies where, you know, you see this far out stuff and you go, yeah, maybe that is the future. Maybe as I walk down the street, they'll have a chip in my arm and they'll know my every preference. And as I walk through the stores, all I'll see are images of things that I like. Maybe that's what we're heading for.
And this is amazing that even though, and I understand, and this is one of the attractions, it was done what a lot of Americans would say for the right reasons, but what we gave them, the rights that we gave up, are going in every facet of our life. They are going to be misused. You can bet as sure as we sit here, they will be misused. And you would have thought that we would have learned the lesson that once you give government power, you will never get it back. And I think in this case, it will be enhanced over time. And that's the tragedy of it. The tragedy of it.
You know, but then again, you say, well, you can't give government anything. Well, there are things that I think we, the people, should be doing. Breaking into my house, not one of them. Making sure that all of us have health care, one of them. Making sure that when I retire and that when my generation retires that we don't live in poverty, one of them. There are things that there are powers that I want them to have that we will control. There are, you know, the clandestine stuff, not thrilled with.
Well, the problem is, you and I both know this is true. The protection that we used to have, the protection of going before a court to get a search warrant, that's pretty much perfunctory now. From what I understand under the Patriot Act, all they have to do is show a judge a piece of paper that says national security, and that protection is eliminated. That's the problem. Not the fact that maybe the government's not trying to protect us. That's their job. Even selective cases where you have a search warrant and you have the right reasons to go into that individual's house, but the protections that were ingrained from our founding fathers have now been eliminated. I think that's what people forget. These are long standing protections, and the irony is, Rick, we're taking away the protections which made us a better society than our enemies. Al-Qaeda. That's the ultimate
Well, they've won.
That's right. They have won. Exactly right.
Well, I'll never forget going to Freedom Island and being greeted by SWAT members with M16s and Freedom Island. There you go. Anyway, today, back in 1968, I'm sure you'll remember this, Jake. I was all of a year old. Olympic gold medalist Tommy Smith and bronze medalist John Carlo were forced to give back their medals. Yesterday, back in 68, they raised their fist in support of, you know, the Black Panther movement, the civil rights movement, a whole bunch of things. They wore, like, the one guy, I guess, wore some beads, you know, signifying the people who had been hung, the African Americans who were hung, stripped of their medals, demonized, death threats, the whole nine yards. Interestingly enough, I find it interesting that the place where they were from, San Jose State University, unveiled a statue, a 20-foot-tall statue of the two men back in 2005. Mm-hmm. And public opinion has shifted over the years.
Yes.
But, you know, when Brent Musburger calls them the black-skinned stormtroopers, you know you got a problem.
Well, I remember those times. I lived it. You read about it. I lived it. Those were tumultuous times. Late 60s, you think about what happened during that time. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. We had that whole fight. You had the race riots. You had that whole fight over civil rights. There was a lot of things going on in this country, and they felt that they had to speak out. Now, we can, you know, 40, 45 years later, we can conjecture, was that the way to go? I think in some ways you have to admire them. They did what they thought they had to do. Maybe some people would have used a different method, but they spoke out, and I think they deserve a lot of credit for it.
There you go. I got a great joke. A great joke. Maybe you've heard it. Maybe you heard it. Get ready. This is one of those rib splitters, one of those knee slapper kind of jokes. Really just prepare yourself. Take a deep breath and breathe out. Nice. And get ready for it, because here it comes. You ready? You ready for this? Okay, here it comes. Did you hear the one about building a big fence, barbed wire fence, that could kill anybody who attempts to enter the country illegally? Did you hear that joke? It's funny, isn't it? Come on, it's funny. No? Electrocuting people, not funny? No? Nothing? Not a response? Something? Evidently, Herman Cain, you know, thought it was a joke. Made this comment saying, you know what? We should build a big electric fence, barbed wire fence, and kill anybody who tries to come into the country. Well, this weekend he said, well, you know, it was a joke. Lighten up. It was funny. Ha ha. Is it a joke? Do you see anything funny about killing people? Like, maybe it's just because we're not that brand of radical Republican. You know, the death penalty people, very, very, you know, execution, very funny. In fact, the guy down in Florida wants to bring back firing squads and old Sparky because lethal injection's too humane. So, you know, I kind of look at this and I'm going, you know, is this what plays for funny in conservative world? Where we're going to, maybe it's so funny, maybe he's got a producer for a new reality show, Electrocution Nation. Where we just put a camera out there and see people climb on the fence and see like squirrels on the telephone poles. Just see them zapped. I bet you'd get some big sponsors for that. But really, that's going to be that's a joke? Maybe Hermie, maybe he shouldn't quit his day job. Maybe he should keep the comedy routine to himself. And I don't know if you saw him singing songs. Maybe he should take up a singing career. You know. He was singing the word imagine, the song Imagine, you know, a Baptist, a big-time Baptist kind of preacher guy, singing the big atheist song.
Beatles hit.
But he changed the words, changed it to Imagine There's No Pizza. So there you go. Anyway, have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow if you missed any portion of the program. RickSmithShow.com, smartphone, get the Stitcher app. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming to the USA.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Because memories are forever, save the dog on the
to stone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walks up and said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town,